We're going to start out with Senate Bill 728, and okay, Jerry and Chris, and I think the three of you can come up, I guess, and tell us why we need this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, I'm Jennifer Weber, representing the Oregon Workers' Compensation Attorneys, and I'm pleased to be before you tonight in support of Senate Bill 728, more specifically the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 728. We have been working on the language in the Dash 2 amendments for quite a while with members of the Management Labor Advisory Committee and the department and Mr. Keene. And we're happy to have the language in the Dash 2 amendments before you. The Management Labor Advisory Committee has signed off on the language, and I'm going to let Chris and Jerry explain it.
Okay.
You want me to go first? Go ahead. Mr. Chairman, I'm Jerry Keene, representing the unwilling people writing workers' comp laws in the state of Oregon. The MLAT committee has worked on this issue because a number of court decisions have caused some confusion about where parties should go to have certain types of issues litigated within their workers' comp system. In particular, the issue of medical treatment disputes. And in 1990, the legislature drew a line right down the middle of those disputes and said issues that involve the compensability of a medical condition should go to the board and be litigated with head-to-head litigation and with lawyers. Issues that involve whether or not a particular treatment is appropriate or necessary or effective in keeping with good medical practices, those weren't so appropriate for head-to-head litigation. They were more a matter of medical expertise and should be worked out through a separate process at the department. And that, of course, occurred. It turned out there was a third kind of case that really wasn't contemplated and didn't fit well in either of the categories that were contemplated by the 1990 or 1995 legislation, and that was a category of cases where the issue was not the compensability of a medical condition being treated, and it wasn't the medical wisdom of a particular medical procedure, but whether or not, as a matter of fact, the treatment being recommended was actually related or caused by an accepted medical condition. And it sounds esoteric, which is kind of why we didn't think about it, but it turns out there is a whole category of cases like that where the department had to kind of make it up as they went, and the board had to kind of make it up as they went where these cases should go, and it turned out where they should go would depend on some arbitrary factors, how the claim was processed, whether a formal denial issued. Nobody agreed that that was a good way for jurisdiction to be decided. It was causing inconsistent and confusing results, and particularly after a Supreme Court decision called Safe versus Shipley. So, to make that long story short now, these amendments attempt to basically draw out the three principles by which jurisdiction between the department and the board should be determined. It basically labels out the three categories of treatment disputes that I just described and said, if it's a matter concerning the compensability of a medical condition, that is a matter for the board to determine through litigation. If it is a matter, just as it always has been, if it is a matter of whether particular treatment is effective, appropriate, that will remain at the department, just as it always has. This will clarify that third line of case, which involves that question of causation between a medical treatment that's been prescribed and a condition that's been accepted, a determination of whether that existence actually, or that relationship actually exists, that also is more suitable to litigation than to medical expertise.
Well, Jerry, it would seem to me that the doctors would be able to tell better the answer to that than the ALJs or the board.
Well, I think definitely in all of the cases, the evidence that's going to be looked at to determine it will be provided by medical doctors. But really, it's a difference in the nature of the decision that's required. The kinds of matters that we're talking about staying with the department are the kinds of matters. Will a surgery help this worker? Is physical therapy a second time or third time around an appropriate prescription for this worker, or is it excessive? Those are the kinds of issues that you would basically look to community standards, read medical articles, look for expertise on the substance of the law. The kind of decision we're carving out and removing now clearly to the board are the kinds of issues where it's not so much a matter of medical expertise about whether a particular condition is appropriate, but what, as a matter of fact, is causing the need for this treatment. Is it the accepted medical condition, or is it not, or is it some other condition? That's a causation question that we all, after a lot of debate and analysis from the department and NLAC and everybody else, determined that that is more like the kinds of questions that we litigate: material contributing cause, major contributing cause. The other kinds of causation issues that control the compensability of a medical condition should also control the reimbursability of this kind of medical procedure. It's more like what judges and lawyers can effectively decide than what you look up in a medical journal to find the answer to.
So you're saying it's more a law decision rather than a medical decision?
I think it's more of a factual decision than an expertise decision. It's a matter of what's true or not true, not what's best. Is that I've just described this to other people as, from the insurer's standpoint, it's the difference between, is this mine or is it kosher? The question of whether it's mine to pay for is determined by whether or not my injury, my accepted medical condition, is causing the need for that treatment. That's an issue we generally litigate in workers' comp, as opposed to, is this doctor giving me good advice about having this procedure or not? Is it necessary for a condition? Nobody's arguing that the condition is work-related. It's been accepted. But the issue is, what would good doctors, what would community standards say about whether or not this treatment should be prescribed at all for this condition or prescribed to this extent? So again, the best I can describe it is, it's a fact question when it's a matter concerning a claim and it goes to the department or the board. It's a causation issue, as opposed to, is it wise? Is it appropriate? That's more of a medical expertise question than a medical fact question. And that's as clear as I can explain the distinction for the record.
You haven't done a very good job.
I think it's an example of why this has caused so much problem, because actually the biggest part of getting this legislation written was getting everybody to agree on the construct of how you divide up the issues.
Maybe Chris can do a better job.
Go ahead. Good job, Chris.
Excuse me. Go ahead.
We have obviously gotten along to this point somehow without this. What's happened to this type of case you're describing previously?
Well, before 1990, they were all decided over at the board and we didn't have this issue. In 1990 and clarified further in 1995, this line was drawn for the first time. Soon, and particularly after 1995, when the legislation had to be jiggered to make it work right, soon after that decision, a Supreme Court case came down called Shipley that made it unclear how you did this. And frankly, even now, I have cases in the Court of Appeals where the issue is, should this have been decided by the department or should this have been decided by the board? Who had jurisdiction? And so what we're trying to do is get at these cases by not dictating this. The approach is different in this statute than has been taken often before. This statute does not try to dictate how to process claims, how to posture these disputes. It just sets out some principles. It says, here's the three kinds of issues that arise. Here's who should decide them. Now, system, you decide through your natural processing how they will best be postured. We're not trying to dictate that, because every time you try to write a processing statute, it's usually got a lot of unintended consequences. We're throwing up some dust. There will be a little confusion, but over time, then, the answer will be more clearly predictable to all the parties involved. They get at the right forum in the right place. And if they don't, this is a very important part of this legislation, and again, it's a little unprecedented. Subsection G of the Gastro Amendment said, the board and the directors shall adopt rules to facilitate the fair and orderly determination of disputes that involve matters concerning a claim, which is the causation issues, and other issues, which will be everything else, which is decided by the department. This tells the board and the department, get together, get along, figure out a way to make these cases easily resolved, set up procedures that complement each other, And I'd like to take on the record that I'm sure MLAC very much intended that it, these rules include a procedure so that the parties, if they do discover through the evolution of the case that suddenly they may be in the wrong forum, that there will be a quick and easy transfer to the right forum, and nobody has their rights compromised or lost because of the confusion in getting to the right place. And we appreciate the committee's endorsement on the concept that the board and the department should appoint a joint task force of some kind to try to work it out so that the rules of each agency in advance will be known before they're adopted and they agree on the rules to be implemented, so we don't have a case where the board writes one set of rules based on its interpretation of the statute, the department writes another set of rules based on its interpretation, they don't jibe, and then we have to get it settled by the courts. We'd like the committees...
So they do it jointly.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we'd like the endorsement of a joint approach. So
I always have some confusion about who has jurisdiction, whether the board or the medical people, and that
mm-hmm.
sometimes it does create a problem. So you're saying that this will kind of straighten that out so we don't have as much dispute in the
Yeah, there is no way to draw a line that will always be clear, but this does a lot better job of providing guidance to everybody involved up front than the current law.
Chris? First, thank you, Senator Durfler, members of the committee. My name is Chris Moore. I'm an attorney from Eugene. I represent primarily injured workers. First, let me go on record as saying I agree with everything that Jerry said, but I have just a couple different comments to make on it. And one of the things that I'd like to do to describe some of the confusion that we have right now is the Shipley case. In that case, the claimant had an accepted knee condition. She fell off the job, and the issue arose as to whether the need for treatment to her knee was related primarily to her work-related accepted condition or the fall off the job. And what the court said is that when her lawyer withdrew the claim for disability benefits, for time loss, that the board lost jurisdiction. And so you ended up in a situation where all the facts are the same, but if you only change the requirement that the claimant needs time loss, the jurisdiction shifts. And that can make the case very, very confusing from my perspective and from the insurance company's perspective. They don't know whether they should deny the claim or they should turn it over to the director. And as I see the purpose of this statute is to provide a real bright line so that it makes it easier for the insurance company to process the claim and it makes it easier for either the claimant or their representative to decide where they need to go. A couple of other things that I just want to touch on real briefly. First, Jerry and I talked about this before we went in. There's some language in here that says that this will not affect the dispute resolution before managed care organizations. So managed care disputes aren't going to be affected by this statute. Second, I want to make it real clear, and you know, this is part of what I said before MLAC, this is in no way intended to affect the jurisdiction of the department to decide cases that involve, and I think we used the language from that's currently in statute of 327, it doesn't affect the jurisdiction of the department to decide cases where the issue is whether the medical service being provided is excessive, inappropriate, ineffectual, or in violation of administrative rules. The department still has jurisdiction there. The big problem in, for instance, in the Shipley case, an issue could arise, how severe was the fall, what really happened, and so on. Those things aren't easily handled before the department, and it takes a long time before you ever get the opportunity to sit down and hash those kinds of issues out, whereas that's the first thing that gets hashed out before the workers' comp board. And that's why I think really everyone at MLAC and those of us that presented the bill to MLAC were in favor of this change. And the last thing I want to say is that we did work hard in the language, but I have to credit Jerry for coming up with the idea. He's the one who took us sort of out of trying to amend the other statutes that we're playing with and that you'll see in the original bill. And, you know, I think this is a really good idea and a good place to start to try and solve this problem. And, you know, we'll have to work with Jerry on this.
Okay. Any questions? Okay, well, I have a great deal of respect for both of you in this field, and if it will help decide who's going to have jurisdictions over some of these cases, it probably would help the worker a lot, so I would be encouraged to go ahead and pass it.
Thank you, Senator.
I hope that the decision is right, that it is a lawyer decision and not a medical decision. So, thank you very much for your question.
Thank you.
Does anyone else want to testify on this one? Okay, we'll close the public hearing and open a work session on 7/28. And the chair would ask for a motion to have this bill go to the floor.
Through amendments to
I'm not sure we have to move the amendment first. Huh? Okay. You move the amendment. Okay, is there any objection to the amendment? Hearing none, so ordered.
The bill is amended
before we pass recommendation. Okay. Once received, we move to Senate Bill 728 to the floor. Excuse me. Sorry. We'll reduce that. And we'd like to also add that we would like the department to work along with the board to make sure that they do write the rules that work together. Not separately, but together. Okay. Could we have a roll call vote, please?
Senator
Wilder? Aye.
Senator
Stone?
Aye.
Senator Green? Aye. Senator Griffin?
Aye.
Carried. And does anyone want to carry it? No, I will carry it if you want that already. But
Senator Corcoran's bill.
Okay, let's have him carry it.
I think that'd be a good idea.
Be nice to him anyway.
Oh,
okay.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, now we're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 643, and we have a... You want to go down there and testify, or do you want to stay up here and talk?
I'll stay up
there. Okay. Okay.
Okay. Well, basically, Mr. Chair and committee members, I introduced this piece of legislation. Actually, I introduced a similar one last session, but the chair of this committee... and I had a discussion last session, and he said, well, what's the problem? And I said, well, I believe there's a problem, but I needed to prove it to him. So what I did last session was add into the law a reporting of complications from abortions by the health clinic so that we could track any of complications that were happening to see if there actually was a problem in Oregon. That the tracking of those complications has happened. However, we don't have a lot of the results. Well, we do have the results of those complications that have been reported, but however, there are a lot of physicians out there that don't know that they need to be reporting this because the forms were not sent to them. These are complications both at the place that the abortion was performed and complications from abortions later in a physician's office. Anybody, maybe a gynecologist's office, most probably that, or family practice or whatever. But if a physician does not ordinarily perform an abortion, they're not going to know that they're supposed to be filling out a form to report a complication, and the health division, I understand, did not inform them of the form. They did tell the abortion providers that. At any rate, we did that last session. This session I reintroduced the bill. The reason I introduced the bill in the first place is because of research that I have done. There are complications, but often we don't learn of them. And when you look at the Oregon rules, we're not singling out abortion clinics. They've actually been singled out of the rules already. The OARs give stipulations for ambulatory surgical centers except for in the case of outpatient surgery involving termination of pregnancy and procedures routinely and customarily done in the physician's offices. So what we have here today is a bill that would bring them under this requirement of an ambulatory surgical center, which does have a higher standard for emergencies for the kind of staff that would be required and various things. There are facility requirements too. And one of the requirements is that they perform a certain number, the bill I guess indicates 10 in a calendar year or 100 in a calendar month. But they also... The reverse. 10 in a month, 100 in a year. And they also have to advertise themselves publicly as performing abortions. So that is why this has come forward. Today I received a letter from the health department because I had asked them some questions yesterday. And I wanted to have a list of all of the ambulatory surgical centers that they've currently licensed. There are 34 of them. I have that list. And of the 39 facilities who report termination of pregnancy in 1998, 9 were hospitals, 20 were clinics, 10 were private physicians' offices. And I asked him to break down the Tri-County area. 21 of them were in the Tri-County, Portland metropolitan area, but the bulk in Multnomah County. 5 in the Mid-Valley, Lane and Marion, and the remaining 13 scattered around the state. The reason I bring that up is I would point out that if only 10 private physicians' offices that are reporting abortions are reporting to the health division, it probably isn't the procedure that is routinely performed in a physician's office. It's only 10 of them report, and there are 20 clinics and 9 hospitals that do that out of the 39. So that's a little bit of an introduction to what this bill does. I really want to bring up the health standard for women. I don't think they're second-class citizens, and I believe that they should have the same kind of protections when they go in to have medical procedures done as anybody else would.
I guess I'd like to express my position on this bill. I'm happy to hear the bill. If we can establish the fact that there's something that needs to be done to protect women's health or bodies, whatever you want to call it, I don't mind considering the bill. If it's considered just based on not allowing abortions, I could not be interested in, because I think the courts have already established that. But if there's a need for the bill and someone can prove to me that there's a need to make this correction, I would certainly consider it. And with that, I would ask anybody else to make a comment.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm probably in the same position. I mean, if it were a bill to ban abortions, I'd probably vote for it. But it's not. So that's not the issue.
Mm-hmm.
Abortion is legal. Yeah, but I am concerned if there are health side effects. It's not an issue I followed. So.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, we have other legal medical procedures that we do regulate on a daily basis. So it's certainly not unusual that we would ask that caution be taken and have standards and regulations. We do it every day.
Yeah, and I don't disagree with that, but you guys tell me that you're...
And I think you...
There's a problem out there.
I'm not a physician, but we do have physicians here that can talk to
it. Anybody else want to make a comment? Not going to take some testimony. We'll start here. Okay, we have Dr. Richard Thurm, Dr. Ben Wilson, Joanne Nelson, and Ken Wilson. If you want to come forward to testify and tell us appreciate you all coming this evening. Help us understand the issue. If you would just identify who you are and you can proceed with the testimony, that would be great. Whatever order you want to go, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Dr. Joanne Nielsen, and I've been a pediatrician in Oregon for 14 years in private practice. And over the years, many physicians have learned to comply with federal and state regulations that have come down the pike to keep their practices functioning properly. And I'm not complaining. I think that they are good, and they're definitely serving a purpose. Some of these include universal precautions to decrease the spread of infections, peer review, continuing medical education, and quality assurance, all helping to decrease the morbidity and mortality and increase the quality of patient care. The only surgical procedure I do is a gonzo circumcision, and this simple procedure needs to be done under sterile technique, and the tissue of the foreskin needs to be dealt with properly to dispose of it, according to federal regulations. Abortions are one of the most common surgical procedures done in America, and yet they are one of the least regulated in terms of clinical standards, safety, and reporting. This is a setup for malpractice. The minimum standards for veterinary medical facilities for our dogs and cats surgical procedures are better than those in the abortion clinic. I've got those regulations with me if anyone would like to see those. I think that we treat such clinics like a sacred cow to exempt them from the usual regulations of an ambulatory surgical center. One of the original arguments to allow abortions to become legal was so the procedures could be done in sterile and safe environments. Supposedly, this would provide a service to women to protect them from money-making, back-alley illegal situations where they could become victims of non-sterile conditions and complications. The number of deaths from abortions decreased in the 60s with the increase in use of antibiotics. But when we legalized abortions in the 70s, it actually, without regulations, the rate of deaths actually increased. Few women will fight a complaint about the treatment given in abortion clinics or the substandard care, partly because they don't want anyone to know about the abortion. And as Senator Q-Tub pointed out, few doctors in Oregon know that there is a form to fill out to report complications of abortions that actually it ensures confidentiality, but provides a means to research and track organ statistics rather than estimate the number of abortions and complications and deaths due to abortions. Hemorrhage and infections are possible complications from abortions as well as tonsillectomies. And I really see no reason why a physician specializing in abortion should not be required to spend time explaining to each patient the actual procedure, how it's done, the possible alternatives, as well as the risks involved, so the patient is informed and can make a legitimate choice like any other surgical patient. In addition, since overwhelming infection, hemorrhage, shock, and death are possible risks, physicians should be adequately equipped for emergency resuscitations and be required to discuss advanced directives, which are a federally mandated National Committee for Quality Assurance requirement for physicians in the ambulatory settings to document in the medical records. Currently, I'm the medical director of the Clackamas Regional Health System, and so I have to train physicians to be sure to discuss advanced directives with their patients and document them in the medical records. And I think we need to meet the federal guidelines mandated throughout all Oregon as well, which should include abortion clinics. Therefore, I am in favor of the Senate Bill 603, that if abortion clinics were recognized as ambulatory surgical centers, they would be properly regulated by state and federal guidelines, thereby improving the care to women for safer, legal abortions. I think women will love that.
Okay. You mentioned tonsillectomy. Can you explain to me the difference between someone, what happens or what kind of a facility or what procedure is used, not procedure, what happens? If you go in for a tonsillectomy as opposed to if you go in for an abortion?
Well, when you go to see an ears, nose, throat specialist, you get a tonsillectomy, it's usually for a child, but they're discussing with the parent or a teenager or an adult about how the procedure is done, the risks of infection, hemorrhage, things like that, and explaining how they're going to approach it, the general anesthesia that would be used, just various issues about the procedure so they can envision in their minds how this would be done, and therefore decide whether they want to proceed with that. My understanding in abortion clinics that many times they don't even get to see the physician who's going to do the procedure. They don't even, until the procedure is being done, they don't get to talk to him and ask him any questions about how he's going to do the procedure and what the risks are involved.
Is there a required difference in the type of facility where one or the other can be?
Some abortions are done in hospitals. Some are done in ambulatory settings. There are fewer nose, throat doctors who will do tonsillectomies in an ambulatory setting. They're usually done at hospitals.
But it would be legal to do one there?
Possibly. Depends on the setting.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I actually have the regs here on the type of surgeries that are required to be done in an ambulatory surgical center. They're type 1. A type 1 center performs an invasive procedures involving higher relative infection control considerations, including but not limited to cholecystectomy, tonsillectomy, urologic procedures, DNC, or provides general anesthesia. You would have to be on
it. Senator Dukes, I'm Dr. Ben Wilson. I'm a general surgeon. If you could defer your questions for a few minutes, I'll address them when it comes my turn.
All right.
Chairman Durkler and committee, I'm Dr. Richard Thorne, a board-certified OBGYN specialist who subspecializes in infertility. I fully realize that any measure that has the word abortion in its title makes it suspect and that a significant debate ensues, where both sides become adamant on their own convictions. My purpose this evening is to present to you my own narrative of five specific cases that made it obvious to me why ambulatory abortion services should fall under the same rules and regulations as an ambulatory surgical center. One thing I agree with our president, he said that abortion should be always acceptable, safe, and rare. And tonight, we're not talking about a pro-life, pro-choice. We're talking about the health of women. We're talking about the primary tonight is the safety of the abortion procedure, and does it meet the standard. Before I begin my narrative, I would define an ambulatory surgical center as one that performs outpatient surgery that, and here's the key, is not routinely or customarily performed in the office of a physician and or dentist and meets facility licensure requirements. The cases I now present are examples of what can happen in the performance of abortion, whether it is performed legally or illegally. The complications of these five cases do not represent my only experience with complications of abortions that I have knowledge of over the last few years in Oregon. However, they are chosen to illustrate that major complications do occur and will continue to occur unless abortive procedures are better scrutinized by some agreed upon standards and requirements in locations where they are performed. I testify to you and God that these are actual cases that have occurred. I have either been directly or indirectly involved in all of them. The circumstances have been altered for privacy reasons, but the complications have not been altered in any fashion. Lastly, these cases are done in a chronological order rather than the severity of complications involved. Case number one, a young girl has a termination of pregnancy at 8 weeks. Birth control is prescribed afterwards, but she does not take them effectively. She becomes pregnant again within a month. Afraid to tell her parents that she's pregnant for the second time, she waits until the 5th month to confer with them. A second abortion is decided on. She leaves on a bus to a metropolitan area to have a second trimester abortion. She pays her money on the first day, and after which approximately 10 dilators are placed in her cervix in preparation of a D and E, which stands for dilation and extraction of her pregnancy the next day. When she returns on the second day, she is asked where is the rest of the money. There is confusion between her and the faculty about what money already that has been paid, what it covers. Did it cover both the dilatation process, or did it cover also the actual D&E? The doctor, in quotation marks, becomes incensed, tells her to get undressed, goes into the exam room and removes the dilators from her cervix, since she does not have the money to pay for the second half of the termination process. He then tells her to go home.
Well, why would a doctor do something like that? I mean, I thought doctors were compassionate people that wouldn't do kind of those kind of services.
In every field, there are people that are good, bad, and in between.
And evil.
Does this doctor still practice?
I cannot and go, and like I said, for privacy measures, I just want to go into complications because otherwise it goes off the issue here. Our issue is to talk about the safety of what happened to this woman. While riding on a bus to return home, she begins to chill and have a fever. Soon after, her temperature is 105, her blood pressure is unstable, and blood poisoning threatens her very life. She is evacuated to a medical center where she remains for 2 weeks suffering from the effects of a massive infection which requires her to undergo dialysis because her kidneys failed secondary to sepsis. With excellent care, she recovers without complications. I saw her thereafter in consultation to determine if the infection she had experienced had permanently damaged her fertility. She was fortunate it had not.
Doctor, could I ask you if clinic was regulated, that would not have happened?
I think that's an excellent question, and you can have all the regulations in the world and you're still going to have bad apples. But the regulations, I think, are going to be able to say the clinic could have said to this particular physician that this was unacceptable practice and maybe have had some type of legal and or peer review process, but it said that if this ever happens again, you're
was it wasn't regulated and there was no nothing was said to the physician that did this?
That's correct.
The question again, if it had been regulated, then that would have been corrected?
Not necessarily. It depends on the clinic. I mean, bad things happen that slip by every day in every aspect of life. But it's a start.
Okay.
Second case is a 32.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Because one thing that occurs to me, I mean, I'm married to an attorney, and there are certain standard practices. And one is, if you know of wrongdoing on the part of a person in your profession, you really should feel compelled to file a complaint and have an oversight board deal with that person. Because especially in your profession, you're dealing with someone's life. And I would say that if you let the person off the hook that you knew did this and caused the damage and you did not file a complaint, I would say you are just as guilty as they are.
Well, I can say that I was asked to testify on the plaintiff's case against this physician. Right.
But as long as we're doing it, how about for the rest of the five? Because I've read through them and... Did you take action on any other case?
I was asked to take action on two other cases.
Did
of the
you?
Five. Three out of the five.
Did you?
Did I take action?
Yes.
I testified that what I thought was considered either malpractice or not malpractice, in that sense only, and not to be judged in a moral sense.
Sorry, I didn't go through the chair. I'm sorry.
That's part of the problem.
I understand, but could I just continue? But in terms of the Oregon Medical Association, were any complaints filed against the physician?
As far as I know, I have no idea.
So you did not personally file them? Okay, thank you.
Do you happen to know, in this case, where the abortion was performed? Was it in an abortion clinic? Was it in a physician's office? Was it in...
It was a clinic center.
Were there other physicians who also provided abortions at the same clinic? You were suggesting that if we had these regulations, there would be other people there to try to force this particular physician to abide by different rules. Were there other physicians also performing at the clinic who might have performed that same?
Those are pretty great. Again, those are good questions, but I have no evidence or experience what's going on in that particular clinic. My main intent, we can get off the is to say what's happened to the woman.
Correction to that is a bill that puts them into a particular type of facility, and I need to understand that having them in that facility would have prevented it.
Actually, Mr. Chair, I think one of the things that the doctor is testifying is to complications. We seem to not think there are any complications, and I'd really like for him to be able to go through the complications so we can see what they are rather than you know what happened to the physician. I think it's too bad that this happened, but I think he's trying to keep very private, as he said. He's really taking an oath here before God and the Senate here that he's telling the truth, that he's changed some of the things, and I mean, he's changed for privacy reasons, names and everything, but the complications are the issue here. And we hear that there's no problem, that there are no complications, or they're rare. And I think that it's important we don't get to debate this kind of thing very often, because as was stated before, as soon as the word abortion comes up, it is, do not touch it. Do not talk about it, because it is it's a private thing. Well, we're keeping it private, but it's important, I think, that we know what some of the positions are.
I'd like to ask the question, could this thing have happened in the hospital?
Sure. There's bad doctors and there's bad doctors everywhere.
Cut off your wrong teeth.
Okay.
If this had resulted in an abortion, is it likely that the same consequences would have happened? This individual didn't have an abortion. They went in to have one. They had the preliminary.
The patient had half an abortion. And by taking out the dilators and leaving her, he infected her. So he did no better than the old back alley coat hanger with the rubber catheter. Basically, once he contaminated her and told her to go home, I think personally and morally that he was, besides doing malpractice, I think he did something that extremely is immoral, and I testified to that in deposition. And so she aborted secondary to the infection, so the end result was, yes, she did get a termination of pregnancy, but after 2 weeks at a medical center, but found.
Okay.
Second case is a 32-year-old mulla gravida, which means she's had more than one child, on Oregon health care plan, who had an abortive procedure. At night she begins to hemorrhage. The clinic is closed where the abortion took place, and therefore she is brought to an emergency room in another city. Bleeding is found to be profuse, and despite blood products being given, the second and a third DMC being performed to attempt to stop the bleeding, the bleeding continues unabated, and she returns to the operating room for the third time to have a hysterectomy. When she is awakened and told that she's had a hysterectomy to control her bleeding, her reply is, "Thank God, I won't have to worry about becoming pregnant again." And the point I'm trying to make there is that a lot of times this is happening to poor people. And ecologically on the food chain, someone who doesn't have much in the financial realm of life. They are desperate women. And so when this happens, the reason why lawsuits and the reason why the public sector is rarely ever notified, they are gratified just to say, "I don't have to worry about this anymore," as a side note. Third case, the woman had an abortion at a local clinic. She had a post-abortive complication of a perforation of her uterus, necessitating a hysterectomy by a nearby hospital. The local clinic where the abortion was performed continues to stress to the media the need for reproductive health services that are needed in that area, and no one in the public sector is made aware that another woman has lost her ability to conceive forever. The fourth case is a foreign student at a university decides that a pregnancy cannot be allowed to continue since it will interfere with her graduate studies. She has a history of one abortion in her native country before attending graduate school. The doctor performing the procedure has difficulty removing all the tissue, requiring a second and a third DMC or scraping. When seen in consultation by myself 1 year later, she had not had a menstrual cycle since her abortion for over a year. She was found not to be pregnant, but suffering from a complication called Asherman syndrome, which means that the post-abortal scarring occurs, which literally sticks the top layer of the uterine lining to the bottom layer so that the ovum has no place to implant inside the uterine cavity. No pregnancy can occur. The procedure was performed to surgically remove the scar tissue. Hormones were given to stimulate the once scar tissue to grow over, and to my knowledge, to this date, she has not reconceived. The last case is a young woman who had a termination of pregnancy at 6 months in a clinic. This required a 2 to 3 day termination process as usual. The first day, the notes are a little bit not clear. Either 5 to 10 violators were placed in her service. On the second day, 20 violators were placed. And on the third day, a D&E, a dilatation and extraction, was performed under a local anesthetic, removing the fetus and the placenta in a piecemeal fashion. The patient is observed for approximately 1 hour and then is told that she is okay to go home. With her suitcase in hand, she returns home on a bus. As she walks up the steps to her house, she collapses in front of her mother. EMT is called, 911, and EMT arrives and administers CPR since the patient does not have a blood pressure and is not breathing. A pulse is found on the way to the hospital. Multiple units of blood are given. Emergency surgery is performed to close the large hole in the perforation of her uterus. The bleeding stops for a while, but then reoccurs in a massive fashion. She is transferred to a tertiary medical center where an emergency hysterectomy is performed and sepsis treated with multiple antibiotics, with dialysis begun to eliminate waste products from her body as her kidneys are shut down. The patient slowly recovers, but after a month in the hospital, still displays signs of permanent brain damage from temporary hypoxia or lack of oxygen during her initial hemorrhagic shock that required CPR. No legal action was undertaken since, quote, she felt lucky to be alive, end of quote. What these cases dramatically illustrate is that severe life-threatening complications do and can occur. The public sector has no knowledge of their occurrence. Even though these severe occasions occur not often, as a physician who treats women's infertility, I will tell you it has a lasting effect on those women in which complications do occur. Hopefully, when one thinks about the above cases, it will serve notice to the public sector that an update is long overdue on regulations and procedure codes on abortion care facilities. Thank you.
I have to thank you much for your testimony. We appreciate it. I'm still trying to understand these five cases that you've given us. Could the same thing have happened had they been in the hospital? Or if you pass this law and there's, say, regulations, all these clinics, could that still happen? I mean, can
the event could have possibly still happened, okay, but the follow-up would have been much improved. For example, at North Bank Surgery Center here in Salem, I get a monthly report with a list of all my patients that I've done surgery there. It's an outpatient surgical facility. They give me a list of all my patients, and they say, by law, if any of the above patients had postoperative complication, an untoward reaction, an allergic phenomenon to any medicines, or other, and I have to fill that out on a monthly basis at that surgical center. If that form was available at facilities where abortions are taking place, I think we can then say what is beginning to get a better handle of what's going on. So it's not the point of where it's done necessarily. It's quality assurance that all the forms and regs and follow-up is done. In the United States, according to an AMA quote that's in your handout by Dr. Popimo, they are lucky that 30% of women that have an abortion from the first, second, third, fourth, or fifth, 6 months, 30% come back for one follow-up visit. So we have a problem with follow-up because of the privacy, because of the personal, because of all this emotionalism with it. Our aim tonight is to say we've got to get through that cloud and really basically say, are we hurting women? Will we continue to hurt women? Or are there rules and regs that can protect those women, regardless of their feeling on abortion?
That's the question we have, is if you pass this law, will those things go away? If it's going to continue, I mean, if you pass the law and it doesn't make a difference, then we don't need a law.
Well, what I'm saying is I think with quality,
and if there's a need for this,
with quality assurance, I think that you have a more of a chance of having a lane on this where you can have peer review, as Senator Wilde said, and for those extremely bad apples that are out there, and thank God they're rare, to those who have an honest complication, that they have the appropriate follow-up and secondary resuscitation to take care of these women before they're sent home. The problem is that the abortion clinics are doing this, but the complications are occurring in miles away at another emergency room. That clinic never knows that Lady A ever had that complication. She never comes back anyway. They don't know that that particular doctor has, of the last 100 abortions, 5 perforations. By quality assurance, by reporting, simple reporting, of post-operative complications and the clinic having to follow those rules and send out a questionnaire to those people practicing, we are then slowly, not overnight, beginning to turn in whether this surgical procedure is a cataract, whether it's a veterinary clinic or an abortion procedure, we're beginning to get the data needed to dictate what legislation needs to be done to, or not legislation, what has to be done to correct that clinic and bring it up to standard.
Are we now doing, I understand we are doing reporting now?
We are requiring complication reporting, but as I said, the health division didn't actually inform these other physicians who might see these patients in a follow-up visit that they were supposed to report these complications. They are going to do that. They have assured me now that they're going to put it in a bulletin that goes to every physician. So physicians did not know that they really had to report these complications.
As an addendum, at our OBGYN meeting at Salem Hospital on Monday night, the new form was brought up. The nurse didn't even know that the form had been changed to show that there was a follow-up visit and was there any complications. The doctors at our OBGYN do not even know that this is a mandatory requirement and that the form has been changed.
How does that information get out, isn't it? Don't you have publications that go out regularly to doctors?
Well, unfortunately, in the busy world, some of those probably go in the round file before they're looked in an imperfect world that we're living.
Yeah. Wouldn't they make a lot of mistakes if they didn't keep up with regulations?
Absolutely.
But, Mr. Chair, I actually think that question should be asked for the health division, and I'd like to see what notification they sent out to the physicians. I don't believe they did, and they have. They have sent the information to abortion providers. But because abortion providers are already turning in forms, and so they do their reporting. And so they've been given this new form to report complications either at the facility or at a later date. But it's these other folks, these OBGYN doctors that weren't even informed that there was a new form and that they were supposed to report these things.
Okay. Chris, go ahead.
And I'd like to clarify my earlier statement. Thank you. I wasn't trying to impugn your character or anything. It's just I see these professions, and very often there are people who do things that really aren't the best. And yet, because you're in a profession and you could get in trouble for making waste, that sort of thing, very oftentimes it's just, well, perhaps if someone sues, that boy will bring it to light. But in fact, if you don't help police your own profession, these people are just going to keep practicing, and it won't go away. But I would like to bring up a parallel issue to this, which is my wife, who a few months ago delivered our second child. Her first delivery was by C-section. Now, her second, that she was considering a vaginal delivery. But in doing research and in reading the New England Journal of Medicine, I noticed that there was at least a 10% chance that the child would either be severely deformed, have significant brain damage of the born dead, or cause major problems to this. Well, it was about 4 months ago that it was in the New England Journal of Medicine, so if you want to check it, it's there. And in looking at that, I just said to her, my goodness, you have a 10% chance. That is incredible. And she said, well, the doctor wants to deliver it vaginally. But the thing is, she could have had a midwife help her deliver that at home. with that kind of complication possibility, she didn't have to go to an ambulatory facility. She could have had it at home. With that potential of complication, there is no law that would have restricted her or forced her to be in that facility to deliver that child. Now, how is this so tremendously different, other than the end result is death of the fetus? But other than that, how is it so different? Why shouldn't we regulate that? Should we make midwives have to be in ambulatory facilities as well?
That's a question that's off the subject. I can tell you when I was in Albany, we had one physician who had about three midwives who loved home deliveries, and he, in fact, even gave the woman an IV Pitocin drip at home who had a repeat cesarean section. He lost his license and is not no longer practicing in the state. And so we do have rules and regs, and we have a credentials committee at that particular hospital, and he was curtailed. He was curtailed locally at his hospital, and was curtailed by the Oregon Medical Board, and he is no longer practicing in the state. Go back to your first case when you said, why didn't I, there's not much I can do for another doctor, another hospital. All I can do is testify credibility. We do have a credentials committee at all hospitals that you can take care of and clean the dirt at your own hospital. We do have that right, and we do that on, I think, a much better basis than we ever did before. So
could I follow up on my second? Because I didn't feel it was answered. We are talking about state policy. We are not talking about individual incidents. Just in statute, it will exist for years if it is not changed by a future legislature. And therefore, it is not based on individual incidents. It's based on what we believe to be the best policy for, in this case, the medical facilities of this state. And therefore, what I am saying, because I do not think it's off the track, I think it is dead on, which is, if you are going to have one procedure involving this, in case of an unborn child, it must be done in an ambulatory facility based on the wording of this bill. Why do you not also require the exact same thing to take place in an ambulatory facility of the delivery of the child by a midwife? Because the same kind of complications could take place, actually more complications could take place.
The difference, as the voice said in the back of me, is one is a surgical procedure, and the other one is not a surgical procedure. A home delivery is not a surgical procedure.
And Mr. Chair, if I could, I would like to interrupt Senator Wild for a second because of the statistics you were quoting. I have some statistics right here that say death from vaginal deliveries is 1.1 per 100,000, and C-section deliveries 100 per 100,000. Vaginal deliveries are much safer.
But that deals directly with the death of the mother or the death of the child. You see, those statistics are not clear. And yes, I have seen some of those statistics. What I am saying is, if death is a possibility, if complications are a possibility, which is exactly what we're dealing with here, these five cases are complications, which actually in many of those did not take place immediately after the procedure. It took place an extended time after the procedure, and there is the distinct possibility you might well have left the facility at the time the complication took place, so that you would have to return if it did, regardless of the facility. But what I'm trying to compare, I'm just trying to get it down to what type of facility should all of this take place in, because personally, with the type of complications that can take place, such as to a child being born into this world, I am really surprised anyone allows them to be born at home, because if there are complications and the person is a lower income person, in all likelihood, they're going to be on some government assistance taking care of, say, the baby was born with a lack of oxygen and has brain problems. That's going to require a lot of money down the road, and that's going to be taxpayers' money. So I'm just surprised people aren't more concerned about that.
Have you finished the next one?
I think so. Thank you.
I just like to say, you know, we probably asked tough questions that we're trying to learn, and we appreciate your being here to educate us.
I appreciate the tough questions. there's a lot of ways I could have presented this, and I just wanted tonight to present it, my own personal narrative, and take five individual women that have suffered, where it was done. It could have happened if it was done at Harvard or USC Medical Center where I trained or whatever. That's not the point. The point is that those facilities, whether they're done, have not changed their policy. And this is, and why haven't they? Because for most part, they don't even know that even occurs. And that's pathetic.
But I do want you to know we appreciate you taking the time to come down and help us understand the issue.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Senator Gerstler, committee. I'm Dr. Ben Wilson. Now, right away, I'll try to avoid a considerable amount of confusion. I'm not the same as Dr. Ken Wilson, who is my friend back here in the second seat. He's a very fine orthopedic surgeon, while I'm a general surgeon. I practice here in Salem and have done so here in the Willamette Valley for the last 13 years. I'm about to chunk out most of my written comments here. First, I would like to expand a little bit on just the definition of an outpatient surgical facility for Senator Duke's edification. Typically, when we say outpatient surgery facility, we're talking about a facility where patients are sedated or put to sleep and have some type of surgical procedure. The one that's most familiar here in Salem is Northbank Surgical Facility, which is just a few blocks away. Typical procedures you would see there would be hernia repairs, tonsillectomies, a lot of tonsillectomies, eardrum surgery on kids, orthopedic procedures like arthroscopy, IV general surgery procedures like laparoscopic cholecystectomies, where the patient will be asleep for an hour and a half, but they're able to wake up and we're able to send them home the same day. OB or GYN procedures would be laparoscopy. There would be certain procedures like Dr. Kim would do, like for instance a carpal tunnel procedure, which involves making just a small incision, but sometimes it's advantageous to have the patient sedated while they're not completely asleep. Now, once you move into the realm of having a patient asleep or giving them fairly potent drugs, or where they're sedated, we start worrying about things like, are they going to breathe good enough for us? And that's why there are requirements in outpatient surgical procedures for things like EKG monitoring, oximetry monitoring. There's specific requirements that we have a nurse there to monitor the patient or an anesthesiologist to monitor the patient. There's requirements that following the procedure, they have to be observed for a certain period of time. And that's what distinguishes an outpatient surgical procedure from what we'd normally do in a physician's office. Now, having said that, I'll also tell you there are some physician's offices that will do the same things as outpatient surgery procedures. And who I'm thinking of course, are plastic surgeons who can do facelifts or eyebrows or breast surgery, various things like that. Sometimes they will bring an anesthesiologist into the office, but at the same time they're meeting certain requirements. They have the EKG monitoring, they have oxygen, they have oximetry, they have IVs going, they have drugs to give. And this is overseen by the Board of Health. So that's what we're talking about when we say outpatient surgical procedures. Now, these are not rare places. I mentioned we have Northbank Surgery Center. We have another place here in Salem that just opened up, the Western Orthopedic Willamette Ambulatory that Dr. Ken works at. The ENT doctors here in town are building an outpatient surgery center that they project will be open sometime within the next year. There's a group of ophthalmologists building an outpatient surgery center. Kaiser Medical Center opened an outpatient center out in South Salem here about 6 months ago. And of course, Salem Hospital is building a whole new wing of outpatient surgery procedures. So what we're talking about is not something that's rare. It's quite common. If you throw that in with the number of other surgeons, plastic surgeons that do procedures in their office, or even dental surgeons that will put people to sleep, but to do so under strict guidelines It's not something uncommon. Frankly, I'm when I was told that the state law provides an absolute out for a facility that wants to advertise itself as providing abortion services, I was flabbergasted. I mean, I would think, if anything, if abortion providers would want to distance themselves from the picture of a back alley coat hanger abortionist and try to stress that they provide the absolute best care that they possibly can. And you cannot do that without providing some simple procedures just like I mentioned. I mean, why in the world would you not want to be under the guidance and the review of the health department? That doesn't make any sense. I mean, and it's not like the requirements are that onerous, because everyone else in the medical field seems to meet them quite well. The other thought that comes to mind is this is a little bit, suggest to me a little bit what the committee's reaction would be if a church came and said, we want freedom to practice religion, and your committee said, that's fine, that's a good idea, we agree with you. They say, therefore, we want to be able to build a nice big building, and we feel that we should not have the fire department come and inspect it, because in doing so, that would interfere with our freedom to practice religion. We should not be subject to the requirements that the state has set up for people meeting in large buildings. Well, you know, I think probably most reasons people's response would be, I think you can worship just fine. Make sure you've got the fire sprinklers there and the fire alarms, and you don't build the roof out of paper. You know, there's just no advantage to trying to exempt yourself from regulations that are put there for a reason. So I would urge the committee to maximize the safety of health care, just like President Clinton said, make this procedure safe, you know, subject it to the same requirements that the same women would have if they were going to have a carpal tunnel operation or a tonsillectomy or a cholecystectomy. There's no reason not to do that.
Okay. Questions?
This is just about how a hospital operates. Now, let's say I am a physician who is trained as in family practice or something. And let's say I perform abortion. Now, if this bill were to pass and I have to operate in an ambulatory facility, what does it take to have access or to be able to operate, say my clinic does not meet the requirements? What is necessary for me to be able to go to one of these facilities and be able to do this? And could there be veto power and say, no, we are not going to do that in this facility, you are not allowed here? Or, I mean, how does it work?
Basically, there's for each type of facility, there's what's called a credentials committee. And you would fill out an application, which would basically consist of the education you've had and your training requirements. Now, if you, on your application, you said, gee, I've never seen an abortion, or I've never done an abortion, but I saw two when I was a medical student, I'd like full privileges to do this, there's probably going to be a suggestion that you go take a course somewhere. But if you can say, well, I've done my residency program, I did a OBGYN rotation, and I did 15 procedures, probably about the only thing they would ask would be for a letter from your department chairman saying what he says is true, and that'd be about it. They'd also probably expect you to show that you have malpractice insurance. And they might watch you for a couple of cases to make sure that you do have some facility at doing it.
Well, I guess I will follow. And so, How do you become on staff? I mean, because I don't know that part of the profession. And how, I mean, let's say I just have my regular family practice out in a clinic somewhere, but because this staff, I have to go to the hospital in order to perform this procedure, the abortion procedure. I mean, do I just stop in and do it, or schedule time in the operating room, or something, and pay fees, or how would it work?
You'd have to request privileges. Now, I'm speaking. I'm going to compare two places: Salem Hospital and North Bank. You turn in an application. I think at Salem Hospital they require you to pay $300 a year to be on the surgical. Or to be on the medical staff. North Bank doesn't have any requirements. Your application is reviewed by the committee, which you're probably looking at 1 to 3 months for by the time they get their letters back and make sure you're not wanted for smuggling something in Alabama. Then you get your credentials. You have a brief monitoring period, depending on what you want to do. If you want to do heart-lung transplants, they might watch you a little bit closer than just plain hangnails. And once you have that, you have your privileges. And you just call up and say, this is Dr. Smith. I would like to schedule a hernia repair or a nose job or whatever. And you just make an appointment and you go do it.
This is terrible.
Now, I might mention one other thing, too, that the reason this is a good bill is that I think state law requires peer review at every outpatient surgical clinic and certainly in the hospitals, which means that after you've done a few cases for over 6 months or 3 months or whatever, or perhaps I should say every 3 or 6 months, another doctor is going to sit down and say, hey, let's look and see what Dr. Wild's doing. Is the patient he's operating on, do they need surgery? Did he actually examine the patients before surgery? Did he inquire to see if they were on, if they'd had a heart and lung transplant, if they could tolerate the surgery? Did he record his findings? You know, did he do a dictation? That's called peer review, and all of us are cursed with that because we have to do it to each other. But really, you know, it raises the quality of medical care, and there is really no reason not to do it.
And Mr. Chair, one of the things I wanted to point out, Senator Wild, the criteria in this particular bill regarding surgery centers and abortions is A, B, and C. The 10 or more abortions in a calendar year, calendar month, and 100 a year. The facility has to hold itself up to the public as an abortion provider by advertising, by any public means, including but not included, but not limited to the newspaper, telephone directory, magazine, or electronic media, and the facility is open for any period of time during the day and has on-site at the facility or on-call a physician license under Chapter 677 Form of Origin. There, I mean, you know, it's not just any old fiscal paper.
I guess I'm still struggling trying to understand why we need this bill. Tell me how many people the results would have been different. How many people have had serious complications where they've have died, have had some serious problems that would not have happened had you had this bill?
Well, I think that this bill provides a couple of things that we don't have right now. Number one, the first case that Dr. Thorne mentioned about the doctor who decided that we're only going to do half an abortion and then you're out of here.
But this bill wouldn't have changed.
Well, no. Here's what the big difference would be. I think a facility that allowed something like that would be at high risk of the state coming in and saying, you folks are incompetent here. You don't deserve to be practicing medicine. We're shutting you down.
So when I ask the question, could this have happened in the hospital, I got the answer, yes, it could.
I think that's really pushing it to
only once.
Yeah, that would happen once. That would happen once because
it would happen more than once in this clinic that doesn't have it.
Well, there is no recourse for the state to say you guys can't do this. There's not the pressure on. Yeah.
No.
You know, I think one thing you have to realize is that we're probably talking about a sociopathic doctor in this instance. I mean, this is just horrendous. But I think it should also be an example of why there should be mechanisms to run somebody like that out of the state as fast as possible. And, you know, I think that any clinic that would allow somebody like that to practice, they should be shut down. I mean, that is just not acceptable behavior.
Again, I go back to my question. How would it have changed? How many lives would it have changed if this law had been in effect last year or year before?
Senator Durfler, I'm Dr. Ken Wilson.
Sure, go ahead.
I'm a hand surgeon here in Salem and also on the board of directors at that new Willamette Ambulatory Surgical Center, so I know what it takes to get approved and get those done there. I think the answer is we don't know the answer to your question.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason we don't know the answer is because we don't have any statistics. We don't have a complication rate. And the reason we don't is because there's no regulation saying we have to have them.
Sure.
Like right now, as a hand surgeon at the surgery center, I'm required every 3 months to write down all the complications. They send me a list of every patient that I did operations on those 3 months. And I have to say, did a complication occur? What was it? How was it treated? So it demands quality assurance. It forces that. And it also makes me follow up my patients. Whereas termination of pregnancy, that's not required.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's following up that patient to see if there's a complication. Now, hand surgery is one of the reasons I went into it. Complications rate low. You know, one or two infections a year, I've got it pretty easy. But you talk about termination of pregnancy. I've never had anybody lose their life over it. A terrible infection or bleeding, you know, that's life-threatening. And here I'm regulated for hand infections, and yet people are literally dying or having massive infections and bleeding, and nobody knows.
I just say that, but I need to understand that we have that. Is this a solution looking for a problem, or do we really have a problem? And that's what I
think we have a problem. It's just that no one understands the depth of the problem because there's no statistics on it. And one of Senator Wilde's comments, I think there's a little confusion here because he was talking about these abortion providers having to go to surgery centers. Well, I don't think that's not the understanding I have.
No.
The understanding I have is that these abortion clinics can become surgery centers.
Mm-hmm.
All they have to do is meet standard medical guidelines giving quality of care. One of the most important being emergency resuscitation. I mean, veterinary clinics have emergency resuscitation equipment,
mm-hmm.
and yet abortion clinics don't have to have them. There's a surgery center, too.
I would go back to, I think, patient number 3 that Dr. Thorne mentioned, the gal that developed a temperature of 105 on the way home. That is real suggestive that there's not proper asepsis. In other words, things were not clean there. You know, and you have to really wonder, would it be that way if the state can come in and poke their nose around and say, where's your sterile room? Where's your sterilizer? You know, what are your procedures? Stuff that is standard medical practice.
And, Mr. Chair, I say, we are regulating in this state, one of the few states, mm-hmm. tattoo parlors
mm-hmm.
and permanent makeup
mm-hmm.
Parlors. They have to be clean.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And my question is, I guess, why aren't we doing this? You give me a reason why we aren't doing it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the deal.
Mm-hmm.
Abortion clinics have been taken out of the law, and somebody didn't ask that question earlier. Why are we taking them out instead of now, you know, being... We have passed laws, and I have asked for legislation to be written for one case of child abuse and the custodial abusing parent getting that child because a judge
didn't have the law in front of them. That's one case of an abused child that was given, that the abusing parent got custody. Well, we just passed that bill on the Senate floor, and it was based on one case. We do it all of the time. We have five right here that were given. We have complications at the health division, even though they haven't told the other doctors that they're supposed to be giving these complications and sending them in. We have a list of how many complications have happened. They are happening. And how can we how will this help? There will be emergency equipment there. And as they say, it'll be a cleaner facility. And I just think women deserve that. They deserve their privacy. They have the legal choice to do this. And even abortion proponents say they want abortion safe, legal, and rare. That's all I want.
Could I make a couple more comments,
yes.
Senator Dartford?
Absolutely.
Senator Wilde's comments about the midwives and C-sections and stuff like that. Whenever I want to tweak one of my OB colleagues quite well, I tell him, I said, you know, I don't really see what the big deal is about delivering babies. Taxi cab drivers do it. You guys are paid for this. And, of course, that's said with big tongue-in-cheek. Unfortunately, most anybody who has been involved in acute care at all has seen tragic results of just what you're talking about, where there's stuff that could have been done that wasn't done. And, you know, I think probably that's why a lot of us lose our hair, is because we see these things going on. And you're absolutely right. You know, children's lives should not be compromised by someone who used to be a taxi driver and now they took a 2-week course, and by golly, we are now a lame midwife. You know, on the other hand, when that's going on, I don't think you're going to find a whole lot of doctors that get up and say, well, gee, you know, I don't think I should really be required to be regulated when I do hernia operations because I know this lay midwife over in Dallas, and I saw all sorts of horrible complications she had, and she got away with it, so why are you picking on me? I mean, you know, it's true she had horrible complications, and she got away with it, but that's not a good argument why I should be allowed to not practice good medicine.
Ahead. You guys have the floor.
It's my ignorance. Oh, I'm sorry. You weren't done.
No, go ahead.
Okay.
I'll
follow up. Oh, okay. I'm going to say my ignorance, too. I'm assuming that in a hospital and a medical surgical center that you're talking about here, that the health division or somebody can go in and inspect.
Regularly, you have to have an update.
I might add, this is not restricted just to an outpatient surgery center. You can have doctor's office that do these procedures who are then subjected to those type of procedures.
The health division can walk into a doctor's office as well. Mm. Is that not the case in an abortion clinic? Can the health division not go in there? I see the director of the health division is here. So
he's not going to testify unless we have questions for him.
Oh, hi, Grant.
Grant, you want to answer the question?
Senator Duke, for the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson. I'm the state health officer and deputy administrator for the Oregon Health Division. And the health division does license both hospitals and ambulatory surgical centers. And so we do inspections routinely on those facilities. We also can go into those facilities and investigate any kind of complaints that we receive as well. However, we do not have authority simply to walk into private physicians' offices and clinics, so that right now, since abortion facilities are not a licensed facility, we would not have the right simply to go in and inspect those facilities. However, we do have, that would be a specific specific authority to do that. We do have, you know, very general authorities that if we ever believe that there is a public health problem, if we ever have reason to believe, by the way of complaints or other reasons, if there are, then we can investigate any place in the state. But we don't have specific authority to go in and inspect physicians' offices or clinics. And actually, a lot of that work is done instead by the Board of Medical Examiners when they receive complaints about the practices that people are receiving in those facilities.
Other than a physician's office or an abortion clinic, is there any other medical facility that you don't have jurisdiction over?
Chair Dirkler, Senator Dukes.
We don't need to look to the chair. It's after 5 o'clock.
Okay. We license hospitals, we license birthing centers, and then ambulatory surgical centers. So those ones we do have that clear licensing and inspection authority. Long-term care facilities are licensed by SDS, the Senior and Disabled Services Division, so they would be responsible for those facilities.
Well, we can safely assume the long-term care facilities are not doing surgery?
Senator Dukes, I would hope that to be the case, and I certainly don't know of any that are.
And unless there's a sparrow there, they're probably not getting birth either.
Well, I'm starting to understand that perhaps they could, however.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now, as far as we're on the subject, I'd like to know. Don't go too far. Structurally speaking, in terms of the actual makeup of the facility, what is the difference physically in terms of the requirements between an ambulatory surgical center and, say, a regular doctor's office, or an abortion clinic? I mean, what must you have there physically to make it meet this requirement?
And Senator Wilde, that's a little difficult to answer because there are the requirements for what you have to be for a ambulatory surgical center. So that's pretty well spelled out. And there's, you know, ventilation requirements. There's requirements on sizes of rooms. There's requirements on staffing, on certification, on credentialing, all those things. But for physicians' offices or for clinics, since there are no standards, they can be almost anything. It can be from a hole in the wall to something that looks something that is in a hospital or healthcare facility.
Okay, so the reason I asked that was because the statement was made that you don't have to necessarily go anywhere to use a ambulatory surgical center, but if in fact substantially larger rooms, larger hallways, more equipment is necessary, in fact you might well have to go somewhere else. And so I wanted to get that point out, that it's not just merely a matter of we'll paint the walls a different color and we've become an ambulatory surgical center, that it could require a large amount of investment and perhaps a different facility and that sort of thing. I mean, I'm trying to get this all on the record.
Can I interject here?
Sure.
He was very nice to send me the 14-page regs. And I looked at, because a point has been made in the past that this would be overburdensome, possibly. And I listed them very simply, and they're in your handout here. And it says here, written policy for ambulatory surgical facility is dictated by the Oregon Health Division, Chapter 33C, Division 76. Number one, you must have a manager, which is a nurse or a physician. And then A through M, you need a written policy on the following. What type of procedures are done, what types of anesthesia, criteria for evaluating patients before admission and after discharge, nursing service activities, which includes education and a continuing education, infection control, some type of comment about visitors' conduct and control, content and form for medical records so that you document what you did or didn't do, procedures for storage and dispensing of clean and sterile supplies, disposal of pathological tissues, infectious waste and contaminated supplies, procurement, storage, and dispensing of drugs, cleaning of soil linen, policies on routine lab testing, and policy on emergency procedures, including essential life-saving procedures. Now, all you need is a policy. That would take no burden. To me, A through M is no burden. I have to do this with OSHA in my office. OSHA comes down real hard, and we have to have a written policy in a real thick book right now that do I have my coke by the ash can? Is the nurse's coffee pot too close to maybe a biopsy that I've taken? So we, as a private physician in local offices right now, pretty much do A through M. We have to have a written policy. The only burdensome, I believe, is the next four pages of those 14 if you use a general anesthetic. That's the key. Once you get to a general anesthetic and no longer using local, then you need the ventilation. You need to have an escape of gases so they're not, you know, contaminating the health or whatever, and you have to have larger rooms. You have to have better in that sense. But up to that point of not using a general anesthetic, I don't believe, as I read this, as a physician, A through M is to me burdensome. It would be if I had to give a general anesthetic. The second point I'd make right now is that of the 14, on the 14 pages, we have a dichotomy here.
Just wait a minute. Do you have anyone else?
Okay.
You're running over. Under 333-76111, which is your first rule there, and this was changed. It defined what an ambulatory surgical center was, but it made an exception last year for abortion procedures on four types of abortion procedures.
Who made the exception?
The board.
Okay.
DNC, or dilatation and curettage, suction curettage, sharp curettage, and dilation and extraction. They were as an exception. Now, that is under 333-76111. Now, as of today, if you go down to 333-76185, it defines the facility types, and it defines a type 1 surgical center, which is defined according to the Oregon Health Division as we speak. Type 1 centers perform invasive procedures, including higher relative infection control considerations, including but not limited to cholecystectomy, removal of gallbladders, tonsillectomy, urological procedures, and guess what? It says DNC. So as I read it right now, looking at the statute as written, we have a confusion, at least in my simple mind, as we speak. In one, under 185, it says, in order to do a DNC, you have to be at a type 1, the top ambulatory surgical center. Under 111, four exceptions are made, which includes DNC. So we have some confusion. I'd like to make one last point, because I know the night is long and other people have to speak. I personally believe that a DNC, a suction curettage, or a sharp curettage, for the most part, can be done in a physician's office, whether it's for an abortion, whether it's for a biopsy, whether it's for a completion. I don't have a problem with that medically, not morally, medically. I do take exception with the last. If you are going to allow a dilatation and extraction, that means that is the piecemeal abortion that can go up to the 6 months pregnancy. And if I think of any physician right now in this room is doing D's and E's in their office, up to 6 months, piecemeal abortion, I think that is absolutely ludicrous for one reason, because I'm anti-abortion, because the safety of the mother is not considered. And I really believe that the health department has to look, and you people have to look, and the public has to look and say, what are we doing to women? What are we allowing women to have done to them? And I believe that the dilatation and extraction, which is primarily a second trimester abortion technique, should only be done in a facility, because most of the complications I told you about happened because of the D&E. That's the procedure that we really need to clamp down so we can cut down the numbers. Not overnight. It's going to take time and a lot of public education and education everybody's part to say that enough's enough. Those procedures should not be done in facilities that do not meet those standards.
Okay. Thank you. Grant, I'd like to ask you a question. If we pass this law, how would it change what you do And would it make it safer for women?
Chair Dirtler, I mean, what it would do in the way of the regulatory piece is that it would increase the number of facilities that we would inspect. It would be primarily doing the same kind of activities, but with this
You're personally not inspecting them.
Not abortion facilities or private physician's offices. We are doing hospitals and ambulatory surgical centers. We are doing those.
Okay.
But we would have an increased load of inspections and following up on complaints on these new facilities who are now going to be ambulatory surgical centers, but that's similar to what we're doing now.
Would that make it safer for women? Would it make a difference in the results of what we're getting today, or what would it change?
And Chair Dirtler, I'm not sure that I can give you a good answer to that. I think some of the issues that were raised today, clearly it would provide some of the things that Dr. Thorne just talked about in the way of the credentialing and the quality assurance piece. And I do think that would potentially improve the quality of services provided. But again, as I think a number of you have mentioned already, you know, it's primarily going to be the same physicians using the same type of procedure, so I'm not sure how much improvement of the complications we are actually going to see from that. The other question that I think you need to balance off, too, is then what is going to happen to the number of providers, and is accessibility to abortion services going to change? And if that changes, does that then mean that there are going to be more late-term abortions, more illegal abortions? And so that's why I say I'm not sure how much improvement we would see from that kind of change.
Okay.
Do you have to be a licensed medical persons to do abortions in Oregon?
Senator Dukes, I do believe that would be a medical procedure and you would have to be a licensed physician in order to perform an abortion.
I have a question of Dr. Higginson. Does the health division have the authority to inspect hair salons?
I'm sorry, Senator Keith.
Does the health division have authority to inspect hair salons?
Well, and Senator Keith, like I said, we can inspect anywhere in the state where we think that there is a problem.
But doesn't the health division inspect hair salons?
I do not believe the health
division. You don't license and inspect hair salons?
You used to.
No, Senator Keith.
You used to run one.
Senator,
you came in with surprise visits to see if everything was clean.
Senator Kutub, I know that we have a board of hairdressers licensing program. My understanding was that we only licensed those providers, but we did not inspect the premises. I certainly can be mistaken.
And what about the tattooing salons now that we license?
Right. And Senator Kutub, my understanding is that's the same, is that we license the provider. I am unaware that we do actual inspections, but I could be wrong on that.
If you have, okay. If somebody complained that they thought it was, why license something? Because one of the criteria for the licensing is the sanitation. There are clear health rules on the sanitation in a hair salon and in a tattoo salon. I know that for a fact.
And Senator Keith said, my understanding is we are licensing the people. I am unaware that we are licensing the facility as well.
I think it's like those ear piercing ones we just did, where we give them, we're going to be given a card that we don't necessarily know what they do, but we collected them.
Yeah. No, you do. The facility is licensed. A place of business. It is licensed as a hair salon or a tattoo salon, and it does have specific requirements for sanitation.
That are followed up by the health division.
Yes. They used to come and do surprise visits. They may not do that anymore. Because of resources.
Okay. Any other questions?
Oh, right. And I do have another question.
Okay.
And that had to do with the clinics. The clinics that are performing abortions now. Because there are no inspections, how do we know what's going on in there? How do we know how safe, how clean? Do we know if licensed physicians are doing the work? if we don't inspect them, if we don't have any regulations for them, how do we know that it is a licensed physician, licensed to practice medicine?
Well, and Senator Q-Tub, for sure we don't know those things, just like we don't know the kind of practice that's going on in physicians' offices as well. You know, what yeah. people rely on in a lot of places for a lot of issues like that is to follow up on complaints. And I would hope that if there are complaints being lodged by people who are getting inappropriate or poor services, that those are being followed up by the appropriate authorities. In most cases, where it would be the Board of Medical Examiners.
Okay.
Would you say that are you getting complaints? Is this a problem? Is it something that needs to be addressed from your standpoint or from your belief?
Chair Durfler, we have not received a lot of complaints about abortion facilities or abortions being performed in private physicians' offices. And I mean, I am not going to say that there are no complications. I mean, we do know that from the reporting system, both the PATH system and one in the one that we have currently running now. But I think if you compare it to other conditions, you would see that there are complications for virtually anything that you do. And there are complications for a number of procedures that are done in physicians' offices and in clinics as well. I mean, tonsillectomies are done in physicians' offices. Outpatient surgery is done in physicians' offices. And I think that those surgeries, you know, have every bit as high a complication rate as abortion. So I guess one policy question that I would have for the panel is, if you were going to do something like require, you know, abortion facilities to become ambulatory surgical centers, would you also then want to take a look at other medical procedures like tonsillectomies, laparoscopic surgical procedures, and say that those too cannot be performed in either clinics or private physicians' offices, but must be performed in ambulatory surgical centers? It would seem to me that would be a more consistent policy.
If this law were passed, would it really make a difference? Would we have safer places, and would we have less complaints? Would we have would it be better for women if this bill was passed? I guess that's what we're struggling with. I'm still trying to say, is there a problem that we need to solve here? And if we pass this law, would it correct the problem?
And Chair Durfler, you know, I don't think that I'm qualified to answer that at this time, and I think that's really what you're doing here, is getting the presentation from this side, and I think you're going to get presentations from the other side, and from there you need to make those decisions. And I'm listening to some of that discussion and debate as well, and I think that after this I'd be able to give you a better answer than I can right now.
Maybe you can tell us at the end of this
session. Yeah. I'll stick around.
Okay.
And I did want to respond, because Senator Cusack has raised the issue on reporting. Could I respond to that too, since I'm up here? Is that I just wanted to remind the committee of what was passed last session, and this is existing statute. Each induced termination of pregnancy which occurs in this state, regardless of the length of gestation, shall be reported to the vital statistics unit within, and actually this was a change, 30 days by the person in charge of the institution in which the induced termination of pregnancy was performed. If the induced termination of pregnancy was performed outside an institution, the attending physician shall prepare and file the report. So that was a pretty much existing statute, and that's been going on a long time. A termination of pregnancy is a vital certificate reportable of event. And this was the new language that was added. If the person who is required to fill the report under subsection 1 of this section has knowledge that the person who underwent the induced termination of pregnancy also underwent a follow-up visit or had follow-up contact with a health care provider, the person shall include the fact of the follow-up visit or contact and whether any complications were noted in that report. So an additional requirement was added that if a patient came back to your facility, that then you were to report any complications, then you were to report that the follow-up visit had occurred. It then goes on that if the person filing the report is not personally aware of the follow-up visit or contact, but has been informed of the visit or contact, the person shall include the source of that information in the report. So that if an outside physician identifies the complication and tells the provider, the abortion provider, of that complication, then the provider is required also to note that complication on the form. But there is not a responsibility for every physician who identifies a complication to report that to the health division or to anyone. It is currently, by the statute we have, not a reportable condition. And so what we've been working on over the last 2 years is to try to get the providers to start completing the forms completely and accurately. And I have been in on a number of either writing letters or discussions with facilities to try to get them to do that. But that's what we've been working on. We have talked to Senator Qutub, and we will get something out to all physicians in Oregon saying that this is a new reporting requirement, and if you do know of complications, you should not have to, but you should report that to the provider who did the abortion, and they should then report that to us. But as of right now, there is not a reporting requirement that every abortion complication be reported to the health division or to anyone else.
Grant, again, this is a pretty invasive process. If we regulate, like you said, tattoo parlors and hairdressers, and we don't regulate this kind of a procedure, doesn't it seem rather strange?
Sure, therefore, I need to do some more work on finding out exactly what people do with the tattoo parlors and the hairdressers and so on. And I'm unaware of what's required for the physicians and offices under OSHA. And I'm not sure what, if any, inspections you have. So, those are things that I would need to look into more, because I really am not prepared right now to comment on that.
Thank you.
There's an obvious disconnect between the AOS procedure, abortion procedure, and the additional visit, because many or perhaps even most of those would not be going back to the same facility. And so it would seem to me that we're, in fact, as you at least partially indicated, we don't have reporting on those cases. And so it seems to me that we're in a situation where we've got to move toward more supervision in order to assure that we're dealing with the issue of women's health. And somehow it troubles me that we don't know more about what's going on here as the chief health officer in the state of Oregon. It's terribly troubling to me, because this is one of the more common and basic surgeries that's going on, and it seems like our chief officer is kind of traveling along and realizing it's out there, but not coming to grasp with it.
And Senator Stark, we don't collect information on complications of other surgeries. We don't collect information.
You regulate, and you investigate, and you have criteria that must be in place. And so we have provided at least a mechanism for surety as far as sanitation and a whole variety of things that go right to the center of infection and health. And we don't have that information. We don't have that kind of guidance for these clinics. And it's just bewildering that we've permitted this to happen.
And Senator Starr, all I'm trying to say is that I personally would like to have lots more information on lots of different things. And we simply do not have that. But to do that would require a lot of regulation, and it would require a lot of resources, and I'm not sure if that's the way the state wants to spend their money.
Well, I suggest, right? Just recently we had a warehouse, we put a bathroom in, and we had 9 inspections. mm-hmm. in the bathroom. Mm-hmm. And yet we don't do the inspections on mm-hmm. those kind of process. It's kind of interesting.
We do have the law right here that says that you do have the power to inspect yeah. tattoo clinics.
And
it's right here.
Okay, and that we are required to inspect them as part of the licensing?
To determine...
It's just the power.
I mean, we have very general powers, like I said, to inspect virtually any place where we think that there's public health concerns.
To carry out periodic inspection of facilities of persons who practice electrolysis and tattooing.
Well, and I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with that, but those the tattoo parlors and hairdressers are not issues I spend a lot of time on.
So you wouldn't have the same authority to periodically inspect an abortion clinic?
They don't license them. They don't license them, so they don't have that authority, no.
This is your health system.
Right.
Senator Dukes, another advantage to being labeled an ambulatory surgery center is that a joint commission for the accreditation of hospitals actually approves surgery centers so standards are kept high, would be one point. And secondly, just like Senator Starr was saying, and Senator Durfler, we don't know the complication rate. And I like this bill for no other reason that if we pass it, then we'll know a complication rate. The reason being, as a surgeon, I have to tell a patient. They ask me, what is the complication rate of this operation? And I have to tell them an answer. And if a woman comes in desiring a termination of a pregnancy, her physician can't tell her an organ. Yeah. But the complication, she doesn't have informed consent on that in organ as far as the complication rate.
Okay.
I had one other question, and that maybe I can ask the next people, but I'm... Grant, you talked about the possibility of more late-term abortions if people don't have access. What I want to know is, under a late-term abortion, are women given an anesthetic, a general anesthetic?
And Senator Kutub, I think you really should talk to some of the staff of the providers, because I know that there are providers that could answer that better than I can.
Okay.
Thank you for taking the time to come down for that.
I'll stick around.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, I apologize to you and to the committee members. I have a young child at home, and I have a 7 a.m. meeting, and I'm leaving. In case you didn't get that point. I would love to hear the rest of this. But.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks for staying as long as you did. Okay, we have some other people, Elizabeth Newhall and Mark Nichols. And Lee Horton, maybe you should have those three people come up and then we've got three other people besides that. Thank you for coming tonight. Thanks for staying so late.
Thank you.
Just identify yourself and just start right up.
Chairman of the committee, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Elizabeth Newhall. I'm an obstetrician gynecologist. I have a practice at Emanuel Hospital. I'm also the medical director of the Downtown Women's Center. So I have my hat in both worlds. I do abortions at Emanuel Hospital in the operating room, in labor and delivery. I do them in my office, and I also do them at the Downtown Women's Center. The bulk of our abortions are done without general anesthesia, although we do obviously occasionally do abortions with general anesthesia. I've sat patiently while I've listened to testimony as to the relative filth and failure of regulation of our clinics. I'm the same physician at the clinic as I am at my office, and we have OSHA regulations in my clinic as we do at my office, and OSHA inspects at my clinic and at my office. We have the red bags at my clinic and at my office. We have IVs, we have EKGs, we have code carts, we have everything that was mentioned today in my clinic and in my office. it really is an issue of integrity, and providers. The same providers are going to be doing the abortion procedures, whether they're doing them in clinics or whether they're doing them in their office. And the complications that were mentioned today, and the point was made by Senator Wild, occur with pregnancy in a higher amount than they do with abortions. One issue that hasn't been brought up is the issue of cost. It's not a secret to anyone that there's been a huge drive in medicine to diminish costs. And unfortunately, what I see as the primary outcome of Senate Bill 603 is that costs will be escalated tremendously and unnecessarily without increasing safety to women. I share Senator Sutcliffe's concern about care and safety for women. Presently, the Oregon health plan, as well as several insurance plans, cover the cost of abortion care for women, whether they be asleep or awake. And what will happen is a $300 outpatient procedure will be turned into a $2,500 inpatient procedure when it's required to be in an ambulatory surgery center. So the cost will go up dramatically, and that cost will be shared by all of us. Additionally, in reading Senate Bill 603, I noticed that abortion has been redefined to include only termination of a viable pregnancy, and that miscarriages will be excluded. Now, what's interesting about that is that miscarriages, of course, are very common, and a miscarriage suction procedure is exactly the same as a termination of pregnancy, but these will be excluded from this bill. Now, what's interesting is that a miscarriage has an increased risk of hemorrhage and an increased risk of damage because of the consequences of loss of viability. So what we've done here, or what's offered, is to exclude the more dangerous of the procedures and to include under this jurisdiction the less dangerous of the procedure. So either...
Go ahead. Actually, Dr. Newhall, I would be happy to include miscarriage in this bill. So I can have that amended.
Well, yeah, because what that means is then every miscarriage in the state, I can no longer end in my office. Instead of a woman paying $300 health costs if she doesn't have insurance to complete a miscarriage, I have to take her to the operating room and spend about $2,500 of her money to do the exact same procedure.
It's more dangerous?
It's relatively more dangerous.
It's more dangerous than you do it in your own.
It's from microscopic to infinitesimal. But yes, technically, what
you,
you know.
You just made it sound very dangerous.
I'm concerned, and I
will add it.
That's fine. Because what will happen is that will have an effect on all practicing obstetricians. And what it will mean is that you'll have a huger number of women undergoing general anesthesia, really basically against their will. Again, I think my colleagues will address commensurate procedures which are presently done under the office setting, such as endoscopy, such as tonsillectomy, such as carpal tunnel syndrome, hemorrhoidectomies, prostate surgeries. There's a large number of surgeries that are currently done safely in an office setting. So in order to achieve a certain standard that you're looking for here, you're going to be hugely, dramatically increasing the cost to all patients in the state of Oregon for a large number of procedures. And again, diminishing quality of care in the sense that you're going to be encouraging or adding general anesthesia in cases where it's not now used. In the 12 years that I've been the medical director of our clinic, we do approximately 3,000 procedures a year. We admit an average of one patient a year for IV antibiotics to the hospital, and I do the admissions. They aren't sent elsewhere, and we are aware of all of our complications. The one significant complication that has occurred could not have been cared for in a surgery center, and that patient would have been transported to the hospital as she was. She's done fine. And in other words, a surgery center wouldn't have protected her from that complication, nor would it have changed how we cared for that complication, which was to transport her to the hospital.
You said you've had one problem in 3,000, is that what
you said? I'm saying 12 years times 3,000, one significant complication.
In 12 years, and you're looking at 36,000 procedures.
That's correct.
So what you're telling me is that this is not a problem.
I'm telling you that this is not a problem. Another thing I noted in reading the bill is that this does include non-surgical abortion, which is to say any medicine, instrument, or drug. Now, we're all aware that RU-46 or mifepristone medical abortion is impending. This bill includes it. My question would be, do we have the patient come to a surgery center, take the mifepristone, and stay there for 2 days? You know, a study has just been completed with some 2,000 women using home mifepristone, and, you know, they get it in the office, and then they go home as the process is undertaken. I think we would have a large confusion having women camp out in surgery centers for 2 days in order to comply with this law.
Yeah, I also have you understand that a normal abortion or just a simple abortion is now about $300, and this law passes, we're going to be talking about $2,500 or $2,600?
Yes, sir, that's correct. It's much more expensive. In fact, if you look at the billing for procedures, there's a facility use fee that goes into the billing. And it's some, you know, $300 or $400 alone just that the facility charges to the patient, which is not now currently charged by the clinic.
And is it increase in cost because of the equipment that you have to buy, or why do they have an increase in cost?
Part of the increase in cost is equipment. Part of the increase in cost is the facility. Part of the increase in cost in a surgery center is that there'll be an anesthesiologist who's there, which we don't now always have anesthesiologists.
But
so you've included another
earlier
patient.
Earlier in the testimony, and you just stated that you don't do very many general anesthesia abortions. Therefore, you're not going to be doing very many of them. Most of the clinics don't do them. So most of the clinics would only be subject to the procedural rules where you have written procedures and you have to apply by those rules. That would not increase cost. That takes a little bit of time for a clinic to come up with procedures.
I believe virtually no clinics presently in the state of Oregon would be able to come up to the standards of a surgery center any time in the near future.
That's
they would
sad commentary, Dr. Newhall, a very sad commentary.
Ma'am, I disagree with you. I practice medicine in my office every day. By this statute, I would be an abortion facility because my office collectively with four OBGYNs does more than 10 procedures a month. I couldn't raise my office to this standard, and I practice at Emanuel Hospital on site in a physician office building. OSHA comes to my office every day. That's how medicine is practiced, Senator Keaton.
Dr. Newhall, how is it that you have to follow the OSHA rule? What greater rule requirement than OSHA, since you said that you have all of these things in your office? We're not requiring you to do it if you do it in your office. We're not asking you to do that.
I can't practice medicine in my office without OSHA standards.
Okay. Right. So,
nor in
what
the clinic.
What greater requirements than the OSHA standards are there in these surgery centers if you do not do general anesthesia?
Surgery center is a place where general anesthesia is practiced.
Not necessarily.
Yes, ma'am.
No, ma'am. I have the rules. That's not true.
I don't know of any surgery centers where general anesthesia
well,
is not available.
The fact of the matter is that is not true. A surgery center can be a surgery center, but not give general anesthesia. Then if they do, they have other requirements. So if you're not giving and abortions that are performed do not require a general anesthesia, they will not come under those rules. So if that's the $2,500 per procedure you're talking about, let's get back to what you said, which is most abortions don't require a general anesthetic.
Most abortions do not.
Okay. So then most abortions will be occurring without a general anesthetic, not under the requirements of the facilities that need the surgery centers that are those that fall under surgery centers that give a general anesthetic for the surgery. Therefore, they will have no more requirements than the procedural requirements that were given earlier in the testimony.
I believe presently for licensed physicians to practice in those facilities, they are required to follow the same guidelines that I do in my office and already do follow them. To require my office to be a surgery center, as I say, I don't think I can just upgrade my office to a surgery center in the medical office building at Emanuel Hospital. I'd be happy to see the information otherwise, but I believe that this bill would require me to take my patients down to the OR to do surgery. And that's what increases the cost of the abortion procedure. And again, I agree that this is going to delay abortions. women are going to wait until way later in their pregnancies until they can raise the money to pay for this procedure, and so they're going to have to wait longer, have later, more dangerous abortions. And as I say, the issue of medical abortions is going to be quite a problem, because these are not done in surgical centers at all. I mean, I don't know how long you're going to require women to stay for, you know, it's a 2 or 3 day process. It's clearly not reasonable to ask women to stay in a surgery center at that cost for 3 days.
It's an outpatient operation. I mean, who do you think you're fooling?
I'm trying not to fool anyone.
Yes, you are.
These people are trying to help us understand the issue.
Right. I know they are.
Thank
you.
Could I ask you?
Sure. Thank you. Okay, so we're talking about an anesthesiologist being involved. Now, in most hospital settings, would that only take place with a general anesthetic, or would it take place with a local as well in a surgery center?
My practice is hospital based, and any time I take a patient, even for a local procedure, which is pretty rare, into the main OR, there is an anesthesiologist there as well.
But from your understanding of the rules of most of these facilities, is that your call, or is it a rule of the facility that says if an anesthetic is going to be provided at any level, it must be done by an anesthesiologist?
Some of the surgery centers use nurse practitioners for anesthesia, but as I say, I'm not familiar with a single surgery center that isn't set up to do anesthesia and doesn't have anesthesiologists or nurse anesthetists available.
Okay. And so in your office, if an anesthetic is required, whether local or general, do you do that, or do you have an anesthesiologist or a nurse practitioner?
In my office?
Yes.
In my office, I would do the local anesthesia, and I don't do general anesthesia.
Oh, okay. Yeah, of course, that would require a facility. Okay, thanks.
Dr. Rule, we had a this doctor was to talk to us about what was required when you didn't do the anesthesiologist or didn't do the anesthesiologist.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a lot less than when you had one. Could you respond to that? I mean, I think that's what kind of
the complications, right, Ian?
Well, the requirements would be different if you used an anesthesiologist than it would if you didn't. So, in other words, if you were doing the procedures except when it needed an anesthesiologist, you would have a lot less requirements. Is that sort of clear in your mind? Is that something that you don't agree with?
So, I'm sorry, I don't quite understand the question you're asking. Some women choose to have first trimester procedures asleep and have an anesthesiologist, but most women choose to have them awake, primarily because of the cost involved, as well as the safety of not having the general anesthesia.
So that, what I'm trying to get to, you said it was going to go from 300 to 2,500.
Oh.
And because of the equipment and so on that you'd be required to have, but if you weren't using, you weren't putting
the sleep. Oh, if I weren't putting the sleep.
Then you wouldn't have to have all the requirements that...
Again, anytime you have a surgery center, you know, I am not familiar with anything called a surgery center that doesn't have the capability of doing general anesthesia. And so there is a fee on the part of those surgery centers, just as there is by the hospital if you go to the main operating room. And so if I do a procedure, for example, in my office called a cone biopsy, it costs the patient about $300. If I do that exact procedure down in the operating room because the patient wants to be asleep, that cost goes up to about $2,000 to $2,500, because now instead of my office nurse who's making, you know, whatever she makes for an office nurse, I've got a circulating RN, and I've got an assistant RN, and I've got an anesthesiologist standing by, and I've got the high-cost operating room of the manual.
And you're saying that if we pass 603, that would be required?
The cost, the facility use cost would absolutely escalate tremendously. Yes, it would. And the cost to women would go up dramatically. And I'm afraid one of the other things as I listen to this testimony that would occur is that women would try and have second trimester abortions. I do second trimester abortions up to 20 weeks. and I do them within a sleep. And I would be afraid that, that women and providers would try and do those procedures awake in order to save money.
We probably have a difference of opinion, but we need to find out exactly where we need to go on.
Well, we have 14 cases of organ provide the rules, so they're very easy to find out. And if you're not familiar with them, we certainly can become very familiar with them so that we actually know what the answer to that question is. And I'm sure we will do that. So not being familiar with a surgery center that doesn't have general anesthetic, maybe then you aren't familiar with what a surgery center that isn't required, that they aren't required to have that, so they have different regulations. And so that might change your view and your opinion and the cost that you have just illustrated to us, because since you're not familiar with it, that means you're not familiar with those centers and it would cost less. That's the other testimony that we've had. So I do apologize for getting a little passing to the caller here. It just sort of... I know we have the availability of the rules in front of us.
I
say that you're not familiar with it and testify to, that it would cost that much more.
Well, I know that we've investigated this in the past when the issue has come up before, and that's been the answer. And, 20 years of doing obstetrics and gynecology, I suspect I would be familiar if it were a common occurrence. So, if it might technically occur, it doesn't commonly occur.
Okay. Well, we need to look into it.
But thank you for your apology.
Thank you for taking the time to come in and help us understand this.
Chairman and members of the committee, Dr. Lee Thornton. I've been in practice as an obstetrician gynecologist for almost 35 years. I actually presented testimony in the Oregon law that was liberalized in 1969 and have done a general practice in obstetrics and gynecology, which included providing abortion procedures and services. Like it's been stated here in the previous testimony, that Oregon doesn't have statistics establishing complication rates, whether they're serious or minor, and how often they occur. And so I did a library research on some large studies that were done just to address that, about the complication rate with induced abortion, in comparing clinic, surgery center clinics, general hospitals, and freestanding clinics. And in one study in the province of Ontario, which was done in 1992 and 93, they actually followed 83,500 patients that were aborted consecutively in those 2 years. They found that there was no difference in the complication rates in freestanding clinics versus hospitals, except in when they compared teaching hospitals where they were training people, and then the complication went up in the hospital, not in the freestanding clinics. There was another study done at the University of Colorado that lasted 3 years with a lot fewer patients, which was with family practice clinics, abortions done in the office, and they found the same thing. There was no difference in the complication rate with abortions done in a doctor's office versus in the general hospital.
Could you provide that information to us?
I have the copies of that here.
Appreciate getting that.
And I am a little bit confused with the exchange between Senator Kutub and Dr. Newhall regarding the surgery center qualifications. You're saying that some surgery centers are set up without the requirement of general anesthesia, and so that would not, what would be the advantage of then requiring the procedures to be done there?
They're licensed and inspected and have sanitation and emergency procedures. There's a whole list. They would have to actually have certain staff and nursing service activities, infection control, visitor control and contract. There's a whole list of what they would have to do.
Well, I've practiced for 35 years, and I do it in general hospitals, surgery centers, and freestanding clinics, and they're all equipped the same way in the operating rooms.
Then I don't see why anybody has a problem with licensing them. That is my...
Well, the testimony here is that it has been dangerous, though. And I have not seen any difference in the equipment provided, the personnel at the present, or the...
Well, the public doesn't know that because we don't have the state health department licensing and making any kind of inspections on any kind of a basis. That, I think, is at least on the face of it, questionable practice, because you got the veterinary clinics got much tougher standards.
Well, I'm not sure of that.
We have the rules right here in front of us.
Well, I'm talking about people. We've set our own standards, too. You know, we have our quality. I'm the committee chairman of the QA committee, mm-hmm. and we have monthly inspections and meetings. And those safeguards do occur.
Well, then, Doctor, I don't understand why you would be adverse to actually licensing these clinics and allowing the public to know. Because if you are doing a good job, then I want to know that. And you should care that other people want to be assured, and it is proven that you do a good job.
The procedures that I do in surgery centers average between $2,500 and $3,000 for the same procedure that are done in freestanding clinics. Okay. And the cost is there because they have staff in their recovery rooms, they have facility charges, room charges, anesthesia charges, and the cost is there. And that, because of the cost, there is going to cause delays in women obtaining those abortion service because they're not going to be able to come up with $3,000 versus $300. And so it will make a difference.
And I think what we need to verify completely, and we should for the committee, is the actual rules on these surgery centers and whether the anesthesia services, if provided, the requirement, if those services are required, and if they are different for those centers, and I think that would, you know, that would clarify a lot here, because if they are required with a general anesthetic, then maybe the procedure would be more costly, but I would think that it would be more safe too in that center because there's emergency equipment and so forth.
Are you suggesting that the present program that exists continue to exist on the same basis, except they would be inspected? Or would this law require them to have more equipment and procedures available?
Well, actually, I think it would be both. They would have to come under the procedural requirement for the surgery center. If they were not doing the general anesthetic, those requirements, I understand, are different. And we'll have to verify that part. But my, and Dr. Higgins looks like can verify that, but I guess my concern and my question here is that we're being told that these procedures are done, they're OSHA inspects them, and so then my question is if they're being inspected by OSHA, why would there be any complaint about them being inspected by the health division and under the surgery center?
By the process they do, or any greater cost other than the pre-post inspection, then I don't think I would have a problem with that. If it's going to raise your cost and change the procedure, then I would have to question that.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of what I would think. If we use the same facility without changing the deal and just have inspections, I would think that would be a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you think would happen?
Actually, I had been surprised by the testimony tonight. I did not know that. I know it sounds terribly ignorant, but I did not know that these clinics were not even licensed. I did not know that. It is worse than I thought it was.
The physicians in the clinics are licensed. Every single, nor is a private office licensed per se. I mean, as the director of a clinic, that's my office, and as a private practitioner at Emanuel Hospital, that's my office, and they're all under the same jurisdiction of an office. And so there are rules and regulations, and there are requirements, and we do have, as I say, all the same emergency backup equipment. So they're looked at as a physician office, just the same way as my office at Emanuel is a physician office.
And who oversees them?
The medical staff at Emanuel Hospital.
Oversees your abortion clinic?
Every complication that occurs there goes to Emanuel Hospital.
Well, no, but I mean, your regular day-to-day procedures that you do, who oversees it?
Who oversees them in my office?
I thought you said that there are peers and requirements for
your office. I have colleagues in my office.
You have to have, in your office, are you required certain staff? Do you have to have nurses? Do you have to employ nurses, RNs?
Nope.
So you could have just, you have...
I do have RNs, but no, I don't believe there's any requirements at all as to who we employ.
Okay, what you're suggesting that in all of these clinics, the people that are doing the work are licensed.
Absolutely.
But the facility is not inspected.
It's inspected to comply with OSHA standards. It's inspected to comply with whatever insurance standards need to be. HCFA can come and pull charts and make sure that they follow whatever HCFA rules are. I mean, we're regulated just exactly the same way as a medical office is, as every other physician in town. We're not accepted in any way. We're regulated by the precise same set of rules. I have colleagues at the clinic that work there. I have colleagues in my office. We have the precise same set of rules that govern both.
I see. The state of Oregon does come in. I've seen them in both facilities inspecting, and I think they are from the Department of Human Resources. They've been in there. They pull charts for complications, and they inspect the facilities. I've seen them there more than once. But I have just one last statement, and then I'll stop. I take exception to the statement that Dr. Nielsen had stated that the complication rate and the complication numbers increased dramatically in the 1970s compared to the 1960s before this was legalized. And she's never seen a whole hospital ward filled with septic abortion patients before her time. And to try to make it sound like the present procedures are much more dangerous than it was before it was legalized is absurd. It's ludicrous.
But I would say since the new complication procedures and the reporting came out, if you want to use percentages, since the new reporting came out, there's a 500% increase.
What are you reporting?
Complications.
I know, but complications can be two times.
Hemorrhage, infection, retained product.
Was it enough complication to fill a hospital ward in a year's time?
I'm not.
No, that's what I'm saying. The complications can be severe, serious, or very minor, and most of them are very minor.
Okay.
But there's still complications. I'm not denying that.
Yeah. And that's what we were talking in the context of complications, and that's... And severity is not covered in this. I'm just making note of the fact that since there is a new procedure for reporting them, there are more reported.
And it may be a way to actually make a study of incidents. If those are reported regularly, then that can be used.
Right.
Well, I guess I still get down to my basic question. If we pass this law, would it make a difference?
I can't see how it would make any difference.
The opponent. Well, of course, they don't think it makes
No, I don't think it makes the procedure safer. No.
Okay. Great.
Thank you very much, Chairman Durfler, members of the committee. My name is Mark Nichols. I'm an associate professor in the Department of OBGYN at Oregon Health Sciences University. I'm also the vice chair of the Oregon section of the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology. I'm the medical director of Planned Parenthood, Oregon. I have submitted testimonies, and I need to digress just a little bit in regard to the earlier exchange about increase in fatality or mortality rate right after the Roe v. Wade decision. It is true that the incidence of death did momentarily go up right after Roe v. Wade. There's a very good explanation for that. There were a large number of providers who had not been very experienced all of a sudden starting to do abortions. A lot of people were learning how to do abortions at that point in time. That very slow or very momentary rise was followed by a steep decline that has continued to this day. So that momentary increase in incidence was a real departure from the last 30 or so years. I just want to make a couple of points from my written statement. The vast majority of abortion procedures done in the state are done under a local anesthetic, not under a general anesthetic. This is a very safe procedure that we were talking about. I do agree with Senator Kutub's point about with the new reporting mechanism, there is an increased incidence reported, and I think it is important to get adequate data to understand the issue. But even with the increased incidence that has been reported, let's keep this in some perspective. The incidence of complication is very, very low. This is first trimester abortion done under a local anesthetic is extremely safe, can be done in a physician's office or in a clinic without the requirements that this bill would carry to establish a surgery center. One endpoint that there is no mistake about is death. There have been no deaths from abortion in Oregon since 1973. If this was the risky complication that is being characterized, there are approximately 14,000 abortions done each year in Oregon. Since 1973, 26 years, there have been no deaths. I don't have a calculator with me, but that's a pretty darn low incidence. This is not a terribly risky procedure. In fact, the risk of death if a woman carries a pregnancy to term is 20 times that of a first trimester abortion. If one has a tonsillectomy, the risk of dying is 2 times that of having an abortion. If someone undergoes an appendectomy, which is not something we're really talking about, that's 100 times as risky as having an abortion. Laparoscopy, which is currently allowed in non-surgery center settings in this state, carries 10 times the risk of death. So there may be some confusion about morbidity and complications, but there is no mistake about death because when that happens, it is reported, it is known, it is followed up, the cause is understood. I do want to comment on the issue of monitoring or certification or adding layers of bureaucracy onto the care of medicine. I think I understand the motivation of wanting medical care to be as safe as possible, and I absolutely agree with that. I would argue that in the case of first trimester abortion, it is simply not necessary to add these layers of bureaucracy onto medical care. These are very safe procedures. Clinics that offer first trimester abortion do not have the same layers of governmental intervention that surgery centers do have, but they do have other mechanisms where their care is being checked that have been alluded to. I would also add that there are other mechanisms. I can speak for the Planned Parenthood clinics in this state. Each one of those clinics are regularly inspected by the Planned Parenthood Federation of America. In order for them to be insured, they have to meet standards. These inspections happen on an extremely regular basis. Other clinics in the city.
Is that member of the insurance company that insures them then, or who does the inspection?
Senator Dufour, sorry. the, I'm not familiar with the protocol.
You don't worry about that.
Okay, very good. Planned Parenthood is self-insured. So, as a self-insured entity, it is itself that is inspecting. And as a result, they establish standards and guidelines for all the medical care that's provided. In order for us to continue to operate our clinics, we have to meet those standards. Otherwise, we would be in violation of the standards and not covered adequately by the insurance that's offered. Another aspect is an organization called the National Abortion Federation. This is a nationwide group that involves clinics in the state.
If you were doing inspections of this type of thing, is there a record kept of problems that they have in these facilities?
In terms of Planned Parenthood, there are clear documents kept about the inspection. We have to report occurrences into Planned Parenthood and Federation of America. And what I mean by occurrences are complications of any kind.
And what happens if they don't pass the inspection? What is there some repercussions that happen?
I'm happy to report I have no personal experience with that. However, I understand that there would, just like any sort of inspection process, if the violations were profound, then the clinic would be shut down. If it was a matter of improving quality, then some...
Who would have the authority to shut it down, would it?
Well, the Planned Parenthood Federation of America would, and if it's not any longer a Planned Parenthood clinic, it doesn't have insurance, it can't perform functions.
Okay.
The National Abortion Federation is this nationwide organization. Their clinics have to meet standards and guidelines to conform. There are inspections that are done regularly by that organization. So that's not a governmental organization, I recognize that. But what I'm saying is that there are peer review processes at a national level that already go on to assure high standards in abortion clinics. I want to also comment, because I'm speaking in on behalf of the Orphan Medical Association as well today, that there was a survey done in 1998 of its members about invasive procedures done under conscious sedation currently performed in offices in Oregon. There were 128 responses from approximately 550 physicians, and the survey generated a list of 33 procedures, which I have on the last page of the written testimony. The ORMA then had an independent panel of two surgeons and an anesthesiologist look at this list and compared the procedures on that list to abortion procedures. Of those 33 procedures, five were thought to have a lower risk than abortion, but 28 that are currently done in offices in the state were felt to have a higher risk than abortion in terms of morbidity defined as infection, unexpected loss of blood, cardiac arrest, or even death.
And which ones were they?
They're on your written.
I mean,
I'm sorry.
The asterisk.
The asterisk at the very bottom. I apologize for not having organized those in order, but those that were thought to be lower risk included colonoscopy, tympanotomy, meningotomy, ophthalmic laser photocoagulation, and laser facial resurfacing.
They're not on our list.
Yeah,
ours is in the 28.
What?
Well, I have a 33 lower risk one. Is that right?
Okay. Yeah.
Well, my
I don't know.
I think
the other main one.
Yeah.
Go to the other one.
My testimony is the one that doesn't have letterhead is not on letterhead.
That's a thank you very much, which is a good way to start.
It also ends with thank you very much, but I'm not done yet.
I agree.
So do you have a list in front of you then? I'd be happy to address any questions about that. I do share a concern about cost. They're adding layers of governmental intervention into medical care increases cost. It increases cost.
I don't doubt that, but you just mentioned that you do have inspections from the insurance company. Mm-hmm. The cost there, you have the OSHA inspection, that's also a cost that some of us to bear.
Mm-hmm.
I guess if there were one more inspection, it wouldn't be unbearable. It can't be that much costly to do an inspection.
I would agree that if the only added cost is an inspection, that there would be very little addition. I may not understand all the details of the legislation, but as I understand it, there would be increase in cost in terms of equipment and staffing and ventilation systems. And one question I would reflect back is that the vast majority of abortion procedures in this state are done under a local anesthetic. They are very safe. As I read this bill, if a clinic did local anesthetic procedures and they exceeded the significant number that was established, they would still have to meet surgery center guidelines.
And that would require a lot more equipment than what you're suggesting.
Yeah. I mean, for example, my office at OHSU, the most other physicians' offices, and we do in our office setting offer abortion.
But if we didn't require additional equipment and just an inspection, you wouldn't find that distasteful.
Well, I'm not a huge fan of inspection, so the safer may not be the right question. Would I consider it an undue burden? No. I would, however, be concerned about clinics around the state that are going to be facing these kinds of costs. And the reason I say that is what I just narrowly defined was that setting where only local anesthetic abortions were done. I can tell you that in Central Oregon, the Planned Parenthood clinic there, is pretty soon going to be offering intravenous conscious sedation to a small percent of patients who desire that, who request that, because they're not good candidates to get through an abortion without some mild sedation. According to this legislation, they will then be required to meet these standards. I can tell you that that's a very significant cost. Now, we're prepared to meet that cost, and we will meet that cost if that's the law. But I would argue that there isn't a problem here. There isn't a problem here, and I know that that's a question you've raised, Senator Durfler. Yes, complications happen in every single medical procedure. But let's focus on the ones that are truly at risk. I mean, if there's logic to the notion of regulation, why, for example, are births allowed at home where the risk is 20 times that of mortality? Why are these 28 office procedures that go on allowed to go on without this kind of surgery center regulation when abortion is being selected out? The comment has been made that addressing abortion is a very difficult issue, and I certainly share that. But I would really ask that you as a committee try to isolate the political issues and focus on medical facts and medical safety. And what we are talking about here is a very, very safe medical procedure. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your time. We've got four more people, but we want to leave here in about at least 15 minutes. If three people could come up and do it quickly, we'd appreciate it. We have Amora Roche, Lauren Winter, and Seth Jackson. Jacobson? Jackson.
You guys have to make it quick because Senator Wells is about ready to go sleep.
And I've got an hour's job.
Yeah, true. So if you could keep it short, we'd appreciate it. well said about
that. Looks like I got the shortest one here. They're very good. They got stacks and stacks of stuff here.
That is not true. Mine is just large print.
Well, my name's Seth Jackson. I'm an obstetrician gynecologist from Portland and practicing there for 20 years. And someone just told me about this about 2 days ago, so I really hadn't prepared anything. I really came up with more questions than I probably have answers for you. But I would like to contribute something, having been an abortion provider in Portland, both in a doctor's office and a surgery center for over 20 years. And from that perspective, I was a little curious about this bill and exactly what it meant. I really applaud your efforts at trying to make abortion, you know, as safe as possible. I think we're all trying to work towards that end. And the questions that arise really is, number one, is there increased risk, truly, of abortions being done in other than ambulatory surgical facilities? Is that truly an increased risk? And if so, are ambulatory surgical facilities the answer? And I really don't know the answer to that question. It concerned me a little bit because there's so little access to ambulatory surgical facilities in these days that will allow abortions to be performed. And I know Senator Kutkov, when she opened her remarks, said there are 20 clinics that presently report on abortions.
Mm-hmm.
Of those, how many are ambulatory surgical?
None.
So we have a list here.
No, actually, I think there is one.
So we have one in Oregon that's maybe already an ambulatory. So
I have to look.
So we either have none or one facility in Oregon right now, if we pass this law, that would be allowed to perform abortions in Oregon. I mean, that's the way I saw that. Personally, I don't. Abortion complications do happen. Statistically, it's great. We find out all the data and info. Reading medical literature for 20-plus years, abortion complication rates for minor problems from abortions occur about 3 to 4 out of every 100. And most of those are considered minor. They can be handled in the doctor's office, either simply with antibiotics, resection uterus, what have you. Doesn't mean they're ignored. Really serious complications, something significant enough for a person to be admitted to the hospital, occurred, depending on the experience of the operator, anywhere from 1 in 500 to 1 in 1,000 procedures. And I personally can't see any difference, having worked in both locations for all those years, where one has one particular advantage over the other. Serious complications I've had occurred in the surgery center. Just coincidence, I don't think it's statistically significant, but for what it's worth, that's what it is. No one can deny, I don't think, that doing abortions under local anesthetic provide a margin of safety that's not afforded with general anesthetic. And kind of the rule of thumb on that has been that those patients done under general anesthetic tend to suffer more severe complications in terms of perforations or injuring the uterus. And whether this is just because they're asleep and you get some uterine relaxation with anesthetic and the operator's perhaps not being quite as careful as you were if they were responding to them awake. But in terms of that, serious ones are more common under general anesthetic. To me, that's the major advantage of any surgery center, is being able to take patients there and being able to put them to sleep or heavily sedate them for any kind of surgical procedure, whether it's an abortion or a laparoscopy or what have you in our BNC, in our profession. A lot of people don't really want to be awake, but I think the statistics will bear out that having patients done under a general anesthetic is more risky than having them done under a local anesthetic. The other thing that concerns me with this is whether if we're going to require abortion procedures to be done under in an ambulatory surgery center, is whether ambulatory surgery centers are going to be required to allow abortion procedures to be performed in them. Is this catch-22 where they all have to be done in ambulatory surgery centers, nobody can qualify, and ambulatory surgery centers are not required to provide the service, so are we in a catch-22 where the service is essentially unavailable? The reporting requirements are a really good idea. It is really difficult. I know in our situation, we see patients from all over Eastern Oregon, Washington, Idaho. We've seen them in Nevada, Northern California. We've seen them as far away as Missouri. Many of them come in, use false names, false addresses, give you a whole series of false information because they really don't want their identity known. They want to keep it private. They don't make them show driver's license necessarily or whatever in that regard, and try and follow up a lot of these patients is really, really difficult. They already touched on the health care costs. I couldn't agree more. Have people done on a general anesthetic, you had the anesthetic costs and the facility costs and so forth. Would mention just in closing that having worked at Lovejoy Surgery Center for 20 plus years that we do plenty of abortion procedures there under local. At the time we do these, the anesthesia's already gone home for the day, the operating room crew's already gone home for the day, and essentially the same kind of staff and facilities that exist there at that time when we're doing local procedures that would exist in most clinics or doctors' offices at the time. We have nurses, we have assistants, you know, we use the same exact equipment, same exact procedure, and really nothing's different.
Okay, doctor, is it legal for you to do that?
Yes.
All those people gone?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine it be going on for, you know, 25 years, 28 years, it was illegal, you know.
I'm just saying that illegal activity exists all over the place. That's why we have legislation that exists to make laws for those.
Believe me, I wouldn't be doing it if I thought it was illegal.
Yeah. No, my question really was, since ambulatory surgical centers have certain requirements, when you said that a lot of these people had gone home for the day, when
right,
you
talked about the anesthesiologist has gone home,
right,
the operating room crew has gone home, there's no need.
And
if we were to keep them there all the day, the cost would certainly skyrocket.
My question, doctor, is if they have gone home, is it legal for you to be doing these procedures there? That's
yes.
Okay. And if I could, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to follow up. You're thinking that if we required abortion clinics to become come under the requirements of an ambulatory surgical center, that only one in Oregon would exist?
Well, no, I asked you the question of how many of the reporting facilities that do abortion are presently designated ambulatory surgical.
And what you said in your testimony is that if we require it, there would only be one in the state. And
I said is that if this is passed tomorrow, there's only one or none.
Well, we've got doctor's offices. We have doctor's offices where the pain is that they're done there all the time.
Facilities right now, and a lot of the misconception that there are a lot of different requirements for ambulatory surgical facilities that may not exist.
Right. That's right.
Okay. But anyway, whoever it is, they're going to have to be redesignated as ambulatory surgical facilities. Now, if that's not a big hoop, and in terms of the only thing is to have the proper equipment and to be clean and all that kind of proper disposal. That's not a problem.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is if we have to comply with what we thought was surgical facilities, mm-hmm, where ventilation, to try to ventilate a building for anesthetic gases is a whole different ballgame than keeping the room clean or disposing of things properly. We already do that. And even if we do general anesthetic, there's certainly a difference between inhalation gases, which have to be ventilated and vented off, versus IV sedation or IV medications to put someone to sleep. They don't have to be ventilated off. And so to require all these ventilation requirements because we put someone to sleep and we don't use anesthetic gases, you know, I don't know where that fits in with the whole scheme of things.
Well, I'll be really brief. This is Chair, members of the committee. My name is Maura Roach, and I'm testifying on behalf of Planned Parenthood, Affiliates of Oregon, in opposition to Senate Bill 603. And I won't go through all of my testimony, although I will follow up on just the comment that was just made by the physician. The way that I read the statute, the ventilation system's required, whether you're doing the anesthetics that require the ventilation system or not. So in other words, there are numerous physical plant requirements that are incumbent upon being a surgical center, including the square footage of the operatories, which if your current building doesn't have that square footage, you would need to do either extensive remodeling or purchase a new building to do them in. So at this point in time, there is one facility in Oregon that can meet those requirements if the bill were to become law. And it's unclear as to whether or not other providers would have either the ability in their current facilities or be able to afford to make those adjustments to their businesses. So just to clarify that point, I think it's important for us to remember that abortion is an exceedingly sick procedure. According to the Centers for Disease Control research, there's a 0.4 deaths per 100,000 procedures mortality rate, whereas the mortality rate for maternal deaths during childbirth is 9.1 deaths per 100,000 live births. And according to the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, abortion is nearly 25 times less likely to result in death than giving birth is. And furthermore, the risk of major abdominal surgery associated with childbirth is 25% compared to less than 1% with abortion. Yet if Senate Bill 603 were to become law, facilities that provide abortions would have a more stringent level of regulation required of them than those that are required under Oregon state law for birthing centers, even though giving birth is more dangerous than obtaining an abortion. Birthing centers are also state-regulated medical facilities, and in fact, OAR 333-76-710 sub 1 states that a birthing center may even be an adaptation of a house. The requirements imposed on an ambulatory surgical center, on the other hand, are quite detailed, specific, and particular. The OARs rightly declare that ambulatory surgery centers need these precise requirements based on the high level of risk associated with the procedures performed in them. However, abortion does not meet that level of risk. Furthermore, abortion in Oregon has been found to be exceedingly safe in terms of morbidity. The total complications at the time of abortion procedures have remained invariably constant since they began keeping those records, which I saw data recently that went back to 89, so I know at least since 89 to 99 that data has been kept, and it's been the complication rate has been 0.3% for all Oregon abortions performed in 1989 and was 0.2% for all Oregon abortions performed in 1998, extremely low. Additionally, in Oregon, the leading complication in abortion is incomplete abortion, which requires a repeat procedure. There is no evidence that the occurrence of an incomplete procedure is impacted by the type of facility at which the procedure was performed, and in all likelihood, physician skill is a much greater determinant in that complication. That's an overwhelmingly greater complication than anything else, perforation or hemorrhaging, by probably 4 to 5 fold. So we're talking about that definitely being set apart as the most common thing that's reported in terms of complications. There are now over 30 procedures that are conducted in doctor's offices that are surgical procedures, most of which, as you heard from Dr. Nichols, have a higher mortality or morbidity rate than abortion procedures, yet these procedures are not required to be performed in ambulatory surgery centers, even though they have a higher risk. And a recent study in the New England Journal of Medicine, which said with regard to liposuction, this is a routine procedure that can kill otherwise healthy persons. In their study, they found that between 1993 and 1998, 5 people died in doctor's offices as a result of liposuction. So I think in comparison, looking at other procedures that are routinely done in doctor's offices, there's probably a much higher need if we were to pursue this ambulatory surgery center requirement for procedures that are greater risk than abortion is. And in conclusion, I would just say that Senate Bill 603 could have the effect of reducing the number of safe legal options for abortion. Instead of preserving health and safety of women, Senate Bill 603 could in fact erode health and safety of women by increasing the cost of the procedure and decreasing the geographic availability of the procedure, and thus perhaps moving us back in a direction of increased self-induced abortions among women, or perhaps women seeking other means of abortion that would result in much higher risk factor for them.
Mr. Chair, I have a couple questions. Laura, the data that you're giving us on the mortality rate for birth,
mm-hmm.
and the comparison to abortion,
mm-hmm.
I have some data that tells me that the comparisons you're making are with first trimester abortions. And that data is that the mortality rate for first trimester abortions is 1 or 2 per 100,000. But the mortality and deaths from second and third trimester abortions is 40 to 50 per 100,000. So I would like to see the data on the first, the second and third trimester abortions. And then I'd also have a question regarding...
I don't know of anywhere where third trimester abortions are legal.
Well,
you're absolutely right. If you get an
Well, I guess they have statistics on it, so I have the statistics in front of me, so somewhere they're doing them.
Well,
might be illegal.
All I'd say is
they're dying.
Illegal, so it'd be an illegal abortion.
But they're dead, so.
Yeah, it's illegal abortion.
Right.
I do have some data on that. I think it's maybe in another file. The CDC and ACOG have, yes, that other file, have got research that sets apart differential between first and second trimester abortion. And I guess, I wouldn't dispute, obviously, second trimester abortion is more dangerous than first trimester abortion.
Trimester abortion is more dangerous than childbirth. So please stop using those statistics. The mortality rate is higher for second trimester abortions than for childbirth.
I guess the point that I was trying to make is that what I find ironic in terms of the OARs is that birthing centers, here it is,
when you give birth, it's a natural act. And when you do an abortion, you are invading with materials, with surgical materials, or with solution, or whatever. You are extracting the fetus unnaturally through a procedure that uses instruments.
Mr. Chair, Senator Chutub, I don't dispute that that is the case. However, the point I was trying to make in the ORS is that there are birthing center requirements, there are surgery center requirements, and the birthing center requirements are less stringent than the surgery center requirements, even though first trimester abortions under your bill would be required to be performed in a surgery center, and that procedure is far less dangerous than giving birth.
My lights go out about 10 o'clock.
I can talk very quickly. My name is Lauren Winters. Good evening, Chair Dursler and committee members. For the record, I am Lauren Winters, President of the Affiliate Board of Oregon NARO, and because of the evening, I'm going to keep my comments very brief.
You really appreciate it.
And I just think that it is important that Oregon NARO wants to reiterate that abortion is one of the safest medical procedures in the United States. And Oregon women, like women nationwide, currently receive excellent care. In a national study released this month, the Picker Institute for the Kaiser Family Foundation found that 60% of women who had received an abortion rated their care as excellent, and another third said their care was very good or good. Thus, it is clear that from the patient's perspective, women are very satisfied with the care they receive. I think that it's important to keep our eye on the ball in this situation. You heard testimony tonight that exemplified 5 egregious situations in which there was medical malfeasance or medical malpractice. And they wanted you to make this leap of faith that if this bill had been enacted, somehow those things would not have occurred. And yet they conceded that this bill would not have done that. That those were the product and result of medical malfeasance, medical malpractice, and they would have occurred whether this bill was enacted or not. And with that, I think I can say that Oregon NARO supports Planned Parenthood and the doctors who have spoken. He says, we don't need the bill. It will prohibit women the access to safe and legal abortion. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, just one final question. It will be really quick. Yes, it will. I won't belabor. I'm just wondering if you would oppose any licensing. If it weren't a surgery center, would you oppose abortion clinics being licensed and inspected by the health division, similar to a tattoo clinic or a hair salon is licensed now?
My understanding is that the health division, according to the state health officer, has the ability to do that when
would you be adverse to licensure and inspection of abortion clinics in this state by the health division. If they didn't fall under the surgery center rule, would you oppose any kind of licensure for the surgery center for the clinics, abortion clinics?
I would be happy to sit down and talk about that with you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much all for coming. We appreciate you taking the time for education. Yes.
Thank you.
You're going to adjourn the committee?
Thank you.
You're welcome.